Well, good evening and a very warm welcome one and all to Dr. Rock's radio show here on peoplesinternetradio.com. That was the stunning Gold Ray and the radio edit of their single Out Loud. We were hoping to get a chance to see Gold Ray at one of the Doctor's favourite watering holes, the King Arthur down in Glastonbury recently, but alas, apparently the bass player had some sort of road traffic incident, so we're going to have to wait for that. Before that, we had If You Don't Start Drinking, I'm Gonna Leave by George Thorogood and the Destroyers. And before that, of course, Party Hard and Andrew WK. Let's get a party going. Quite so. And with that in mind, the festival season is almost upon us. And as most of you will know by now, I spend a fair bit of my time presenting and crewing at various festivals around the place. First one up is going to be The Fire in the Mountain, one of my personal favourites, which sold out pretty much as soon as the tickets went on sale this year, so that's going to be a pretty elitist gig, the kind of thing that we don't normally get to go to. But one of the ones I want to think about tonight is called The Conscious Tribal Gathering, which is something that grew out of, originally it grew out of the Truth Juice gatherings, which we've heard many interviews from in my time on People's Internet Radio and MSI and TNS. They used to be, I think there might be another one this year, but they're tremendously productive events. They are, there's a lot of meetings, a lot of very interesting and varied presenters, and the gig I'm thinking about tonight is called The Conscious Tribal Gathering, and it's going to be happening between July the 23rd and Monday the 27th of July in Glyndyfrdwy in North Wales, which is almost as difficult to say as it is to spell. The summary of it on their little website says it's a family-friendly event to connect with like-minded souls and explore the inner and outer spaces of our human existence and beyond, which is certainly what Truth Juice does. An eclectic selection of speakers and workshops to enlighten and entertain, set on a private site deep in the Dee Valley in North Wales. Respecting respectful freedom of choice in this ever-increasingly controlled world, holding up for tolerance, compassion, altruism and unconditional love as key components of our being. And being conscious that we are all on our own individual path and each have something unique to share with the tribe. As a family-friendly event, we hope that you can respect a chilled vibe with no excessive drinking and accept that smoking is strongly discouraged in enclosed areas and around food zones. But we do all have the freedom to do what we want to do. As I've said before, it is really great to be at these events, especially if you're a working part of what's going on. I've found many years ago when I went to a gig in Spain that actually being part of the crew hugely increases the enjoyment of what's going on, and it means that you can be practically involved, and it just makes the whole thing more real than simply handing over some promissory tokens to come along and listen. But more important even than that, I think, especially at these talky gigs, is the mixture of people. The fact that when many lovely people who've all got interesting ideas of their own, and many of whom have had some quite extreme experiences one way or the other, actually get together in a field and spend a bit of time eating together and chatting together, you get an absolutely fabulous atmosphere. And although everybody's coming from a different perspective, it's a rare opportunity in a world that sees us all separated from each other so often to share ideas and to bounce off other people's discoveries. I always remember from the Truth Juice gatherings that I've been to how completely joyful people look when they're leaving. Sometimes it's the first such event that they've been to. Other times they're veterans of such things, but they really are special gigs, and I'm fully anticipating that the Conscious Tribal Gathering is going to be one such event. I'm really looking forward to it. Synchro and I will be there doing the Ceremony of Original Innocence for anybody who's about, and giving a bit of an intro to the ceremonies, which I was talking about on the show a few weeks back. PIR's own Clive DeCarle's going to be there as well. I'm really looking forward to hearing him live. And another character that's going to be there is an individual called Stephen Hall, who is tonight's guest. After the next tune, I'll be trying to call him up, now that I can see that everything's working properly. And the tribal gathering notice on the website for him says that he's been successful teaching manifestation principles for almost a decade, and that is something that we have touched on before in this show. But having looked at Steve's stuff and listened to some of his videos and things, I think he's really got a slant on it, which I find has really fired my enthusiasm for another go. DJ Didge, who I believe wrote the input for the website, says that his style is firmly grounded in psychological roots but with a distinct spiritual focus, and that his metaphysical career began with stage hypnosis, which I find quite an interesting subject in itself, but he quickly progressed and became a certified hypnotherapist and NLP practitioner. So hopefully we'll get a chance to talk about that a bit. By 2000, Stephen was attending advanced meditation classes and turned his focus to spiritual growth. He's a gifted healer and teaches manifestation principles to assist people in uncovering and following their true life path. And his ultimate goal in life is to assist the spiritual evolution of humanity so that we can consciously ascend together as a race. He's also written a book called Wishing Well, a guide to creating your dreams through cosmic ordering. And I read he's actually got a whole load of testimonials for that book up on one of his several websites, and many of the people in their testimonials are mentioning the fact that they have maybe for 10 or 20 years been experimenting with these manifestation techniques, which, as I think we'll discover, are actually quite ancient in their origins, but that it's never quite worked for them, but that having consulted Stephen's material, they're finding it's all a lot more successful. And let's face it, folks, we could really do with manifesting ourselves a little bit more than what seems to be being doled out to us currently. So I'm going to play one more tune whilst I call up Steve, get him on the line. Patti Smith there, and Because the Night Belongs to Love. Now, as advertised, I should now have on the line tonight's guest, Stephen Hall. Thank you very much for joining us, Stephen, and a very, very warm welcome to People's Internet Radio and to the Dr. Rock Radio Show. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, thanks very much. It's my pleasure to be here.
So, I guess it'd be useful for the folks to know, before we get talking about your manifestation techniques a little bit later, perhaps it'd be good to know a little bit about yourself, because the things I've caught is basically drummer, DJ, followed by stage hypnotist. How did all of that come?
Oh, stage hypnosis came first.
Did it? Yeah. Oh, right, yeah. So
many years ago, yeah.
Right, what made you choose stage hypnosis as one of your earliest things to experiment with? Sounds a bit brave to me.
Because I was 18, and it seemed like a good way to seduce girls. I had a massive ego, and I'd kind of stumbled into hypnosis by accident. And I was looking through this Arthur C. Clarke book, and it got this guy levitating, but it was just a drawing. And one of the possible explanations was that people had been hypnotized to not see a chair. And that was the first time I'd considered this idea of hypnosis being such a powerful thing that changes our perception. So that's what started me on it. And I did a few experiments on some friends. I kind of researched as much as I could. I even volunteered for some stage hypnosis shows and then went to see kind of from both sides. And the first guy I ever hypnotized, just out of pure luck, I told him it was getting colder and colder, and he got goosebumps. And I thought, well, you can't fake that. So that was pretty cool. So that changed me into actually believing in hypnosis. But yeah, that started out as a career as a stage hypnotist.
What was it like volunteering for other to be hypnotized in front of an audience? How did that go for you?
Well, I am a rubbish hypnotic subject. I'm a bit of an insomniac, so I've got kind of a bit of a monkey mind. So I didn't really go into trance, but I wanted to see if there was any kind of secret little things that he was whispering to us. So I was really kind of infiltrating the other side to see whether or not there were some secrets that we weren't taught in the books. So that was the idea behind it. So I did sort of act, but I also played along a little bit as well. And I was kind of under a little bit, but not enough to be totally comfortable with what was going on. But after the show, I kind of went up to the guy and I said, I'm studying hypnosis as well. And he asked me who my tutor was. And I said, no, I'm studying it on my own. And he told me I'd never make it. And that kind of gave me the motivation then to actually do it and actually get somewhere. But Yeah, for a long time, I was hypnotising people. I didn't actually believe in it. So I thought they were all faking. But I thought, well, it's entertainment, so why not? And then when the chap got the goosebumps, and the next suggestion I gave him was that it was getting really, really hot. And the goosebumps all went away and he started to sweat. Now, obviously, you can't fake either of those two responses. That's a physiological response to something, just from a suggestion. So that was the turning point for me. So.
And did that make your hypnosis more convincing, the fact that you were more convinced by it?
Yeah, oh, definitely. Yeah, yeah. When I started to believe in it, I had a little bit more confidence in trying more outlandish things. But, I mean, it's the stage hypnosis, this is going way back to the early 90s. I did my last stage show in 1994. And a lot of people used to come up to me after the show asking if I could hypnotize them for weight loss and smoking and confidence and all that kind of thing, which I had no clue how to do any of that. But I did a lot of experiments with friends, and I started to I kind of brought in a little bit of NLP and tried to move people in a direction of what they wanted to achieve, and then drifted quite naturally over to hypnotherapy. And I think in the early days with the stage hypnosis, it was an ego boost. You know, it feels good. And I was only 18 years old. So that was really important to me. And then when I moved over to hypnotherapy, it changed from being something that was an ego boost to something that was quite heartwarming. You know, you're kind of just saying something to a person and you're changing, completely changing their life. If you're removing a phobia or stopping an addiction, that can transform that person's family. So that became something that was so much more rewarding than just, you know, having a laugh on stage. So the hypnotherapy then led on to becoming like a spiritual healer and eventually came on to the law of attraction and manifestation. So those kind of things.
And I've heard really good reports about hypnotherapy, not only with phobias and addictions, but with really some quite spectacular problems. How did it work for you?
I had really good success with hypnosis. And I think the secret to my success was I was very, very much focused on a positive outcome. I'm a firm believer, whatever you focus on, you magnify. So you get more of what you're focused on as opposed to what you're trying to move away from. And I know, I mean, way back when I started learning hypnotherapy techniques, they were talking about smoking making you feel sick. So it's kind of like an aversion therapy thing. Well, I didn't like that. I liked the idea of moving someone towards something that was better. So in my mind, we'd got someone who was a smoker, and if they was trying to become a non-smoker, the old method was kind of giving something up that they liked, whereas I preferred the idea of stepping up to something that was even better than what they were. So it felt like they'd become more. They'd become a non-smoker. So they had this much better lifestyle. So I was very much interested in the idea of moving people in a positive direction towards something that would be better for them than what they had previously tried to move away from.
So you're basically kind of engaging their own enthusiasm as an engine for change.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's kind of like the carrot and the stick, isn't it? I think the aversion stuff where smoking makes you feel ill, that's the stick. And kind of we do need to be hit a little bit and we need to be scared a little bit just to get us moving. And for me, where motivation comes from, that's like first gear in your car. It's you do need to scare yourself into action sometimes, and that causes you to start doing something. But if we stayed in first gear, you'd burn the engine out. And I think what a lot of people do when they're trying to change their lives, you know, we see that we're in debt, so we try and do something about it. But if we keep focusing on the debt, we're going to crash. And that's what happens in people's lives, as opposed to as soon as you've started the motivation, you need to get up into second, third, and up into fifth gear, which is focusing on what you desire and then moving forward towards that and keeping focused on that and having like the positive motivation to move you towards it. So that's in the hypnotic, when I was doing hypnotherapy, that became really important to me. And then using NLP techniques like the swish pattern and bringing in different modalities, that made that really easy. So it became really easy to kind of paint a picture of someone's future, project them into it, and then get them to enjoy the feelings of that, bring it back into the present, and use those feelings of motivation to make it happen. So, I mean, that started out just with hypnosis, like losing weight, quitting smoking, becoming more confident, all those kind of things. And then I started to get more into the law of attraction, and I was thinking, well, can I use these same techniques to get people to manifest stuff that we would consider that is outside of ourselves? So that's kind of how that led on to the law of attraction for me.
So you were basically using the NLP, I guess, to improve your ability to suggest and convince people to think in new ways. Is that right?
Well, it's all about making the experience more real for them. So, I mean, the big The big thing with NLP for me is the submodalities. It's like having a remote control for a person. You get them to imagine something, and then you turn up the brightness, you bring it nice and close, you make sure they're associated into it, you turn up the sounds, you make it really loud and booming, and it's just like adjusting your TV set. If you can make it bigger and brighter and more colourful, then that really seduces their senses, and that's what enables them to get more emotion. And it's all about emotion. Emotion is what causes things to manifest. It's what causes us to move in a direction. Now, the emotion can be positive, which is what we're aiming towards, or the emotion can be negative, like worry and fear and all that kind of stuff. It still causes things to happen. And it's kind of the clues in the name. We're talking about emotions, and it moves you. There is motion, there is movement, and it could be a movement towards what you want, or unfortunately, it could be a movement towards something that you really, really don't want. But the manifestation process still happens. We can't get away from that.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because really, it seems to me that emotional motivation is what's generally being exercised upon us as individuals, in that, you know, when you look at the television and see all of the fear and the soap opera drama, it's kind of encouraging us to be frightened. And so our manifestations are going to be along those lines. There's a sense.
I think it goes deeper than that. It's like the adverts where there's blame, there's a claim. That takes responsibility of something from ourselves to some external, and it immediately strips of us our power. I don't believe in any way whatsoever in accidents. I mean, I've had lots of accidents. I've broken lots of bones. But I don't believe that they happened for any other reason than I created them for me to have an experience, for me to go through a learning. There's a book by somebody called Debbie Shapiro, I think I'm pronouncing that correctly, called The Body-Mind Workbook. And it talks about different parts of your body and if you have an illness or an ailment, what that means and what's that trying to communicate to you. And it even goes to the extent of saying, you know, if you fall over and break a hip, what that means. Hips are to do with the start of your legs, the start of the direction that you're going. If you don't like the direction you're going in life, then your hips are going to be vulnerable. So you might fall over and break one because you're approaching a point in your life that you're a bit worried about, which might explain why a lot of old people could fall and break their hips when they're getting towards a part of their life when they're starting to think about kind of death and that kind of stuff. But yeah, I don't believe in accidents. I don't believe in any kind of situation being external to you. If it's happened to you, you've created it. If it's good or if it's bad, you've still created it.
I think that that's a very good point, is that it's easy to blame other people for what's going on for us, but I've always held that we're at least 50% responsible.
Well, I think there's a little bit of a caveat, really, because let's take money, for example. We are conditioned by society into thinking that having money is somehow bad and evil, and being poor is somehow good. Now, if you look at the film Titanic, we can associate with the hero of the film, the Leonardo DiCaprio character. Now, he's downstairs, he's dancing on tables, having a great time, having a lot of fun. He gets the girl, he's the hero, he's the good guy. And we want to associate with all that stuff, but he's the poor guy. The other guy in the film, who actually plays the rich character, you know, they're all backstabbing and, you know, it's the villain of the film. We don't want to associate with that. So that goes in at a subconscious level to say being poor is somehow a good thing. You'll have a lot of fun, you'll be a winner. And being rich is a bad thing. And we have that kind of conditioning in our society everywhere. All films do it, all the media does it. And I often challenge people, because I know a lot of people do think that having wealth and abundance is in some way bad or evil. What I'd like to say is to ask a person, do you consider yourself a good person? And pretty much everybody says yes, especially to the people I speak to, because they're all spiritual people. And then I'll say, how much money do I have to give you in order for you to decide off your own back to become an evil person? You know, if I gave you £10,000 right now, would that be enough? And obviously, they're going to say no. I mean, would £1 million be enough? You know, it's insane. There isn't an amount of money I can just give to a person that's a good person for them to suddenly decide, now I'm this rich, I'm going to stop being good and start being bad. That doesn't happen. Money doesn't do that. All it does is magnify what that person already is. So in our society, we've got a bunch of people that have been convinced that money is somehow evil and they shun money, but the money's still there. And then we've got another bunch of people that are, you know, not necessarily nice people that want to use that money for negative things, which are going to say, we'll take it. We're happy to use it. And I think that's a bit of a problem. We have a lot of associations in spirituality that connect being poor with being good and being rich with being bad. And I think it would be a lot better if some incredibly spiritual people could take a bit of a share of that wealth and then do really awesome spiritual things with it. Because if, I mean, in our society, the more money we've got, the more good we can do.
Well, the Pope's an incredibly spiritual person. He's got shed loads of cash.
Yeah. Shed loads of gold as well.
Yeah, I think there's a couple of things there. One of the things is that as several of us who've, I mean, I know people who are experimenting with getting by with no money at all, which is a pretty brave move. But I think certainly most of us have recognised now that without some of that, it is like a representation of the vital life flow. It's the only one that we've actually got at the moment, and we kind of have to engage with it.
For me, it just kind of makes stuff easy, you know. If we didn't have it and we went back to the bartering system, I mean, this is what fills the gaps between me wanting something and being able to exchange it for something that I've got. But, I mean, I kind of like it. I like the system that we're in at the moment, but I'm enough withdrawn from it for it to not be directly affecting me in a negative way. I mean, I've not watched a news broadcast for a ridiculous amount of time. I completely removed myself from much of what's going on, because there's a lot of good stuff going on that we're not told about, and there's a lot of bad stuff going on that's kind of rammed down our throat every time we turn on the TV. So for me, it's not really worth turning on the TV. So
yeah, no, I'm pretty much in the same position there.
Yeah,
really.
Yeah. As long as you don't negatively let it affect you, and you realise that, there is that control there, and there's this kind of dogma that's going on that's trying to condition us in a certain way, as long as you can remove yourself from that, you get your own power back and it doesn't affect you in a negative way. But it is hard to do that because it's being drip fed to us from everywhere all the time. You know, adverts on TV, movies that we watch. It's a theme that's underneath everything. So if we are in that environment, it is quite tricky.
But your own experience as a hypnotherapist and stuff suggests, must have shown pretty demonstrably that the subconscious is a really important part of what's going on and how things work for us.
Gotcha.
And as you've just suggested with your reference to the film Titanic, there's all these kind of subliminal messages that are being hammered home. Do you think that actually being aware that that's going on limits the effect that these things will have on you to a certain extent?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it does still affect you, but it gives you a choice. If you can see it, then the effect is nowhere near as much as it would have been. There are some experiments, as it goes, that have looked at this idea of something being completely subliminal and whether it still affects you once we're consciously made aware of it. And the results of those experiments were that it does still affect you. But I kind of think if it is something that is affecting you in a way you don't want to be affected, and you can see it and you know it's going on, you can choose the opposite. You can choose to watch it as something external. And I think the problem is, especially where films are concerned, is our subconscious minds don't separate that from reality. I mean, if we did, then no horror film would be scary. We'd sit there watching it, knowing that it's, a fake story that's actually on a TV and there's nothing threatening us, but we don't. We do watch it and get scared. So it just shows how much your subconscious mind can be seduced by these things without you realising it's having an effect on you.
I've been told that our subconscious mind actually, to all intents and purposes, when you do MRI scans or whatever, you can see that the mind is accepting the horror movie in exactly the same way as it would if it was real.
Yeah, it has to, otherwise it wouldn't be scary, would it? So,
No, that's true, I guess. I had on the subject of money, I had a lovely chat with a young man who knew how money was created and what it was doing and how it was being used and all that sort of stuff. But he said that's not the level on which we have to deal with it. For us, it's the milk of the mother. It's what keeps us going.
Yeah, very true.
Which I think is a really great way of putting it. So, how long did you do the hypnotherapy for? And after that, you started looking at meditation. Is that right?
I think all these things kind of overlapped a little. Originally, I was a DJ. That led on to the stage hypnosis because I've got quite a few contacts in the club scene. That came on to the hypnotherapy. And I started hypnotherapy in the early 90s, probably about 92, 93, because there was a crossover period. And I was doing that, running a private clinic just from home for maybe about 6 or 7 years. And I was getting quite good results, just doing word of mouth, didn't do any advertising. And then I thought, I'd best go and get some qualifications in this and get a certificate to put on the wall. You know, and for a long time, I really thought if I'm getting the results, doesn't matter whether I've got any formal training, because I've just been obsessed with it and I've kind of learnt it just by you know, going out there and just finding out what I could have for my own back. So I went off and did a diploma course, and I went back to college and did psychology. And I couldn't believe how little they teach people and then unleash you on the public with letters after your name and certificates for your wall and that kind of stuff. It's insane. But because I was so obsessed with the subject anyway, that meant that I'd gone into it, you know, quite a bit deeper. And also, I think what worked really well for me is because I didn't have a formal education in therapy, but I was doing it anyway, I was kind of doing some wacky experiments which were a little bit more unorthodox that I perhaps wouldn't have done if I was worried about my accredited status. So...
So with sort of 6 or 7 years experience, you must have seen a lot of different people and learnt a lot of stuff. How much training did you get in your psychology to do with hypnotherapy?
Practically none. I did a psychology A level. I did plan on going on and doing a degree from it. This was all in night class, going back as a mature student. But the stuff they was teaching us in the psychology A level, we got to the section when we was talking about phobias, and we were talking about flooding and systematic desensitization, where it takes a really, really long time to get someone to put up with their phobia but not overcome it. And I was doing the NLP fast phobia cure in, you know, it takes about 5 minutes, but you pad it out so the session seems like it's worth its money. So you really do. The actual therapy is just a little bit in the middle. But how quick it happens. I was on a tube train down in London a few years ago. And I was down in London for business, and I was just on my own. And there was a couple of girls sat next to me on the tube who were smoking hot. And it's every guy in the carriage were looking at these two girls, and they were talking about the lift at the next stop that they were going to have to take. And one of them was saying how petrified she was, and she doesn't want to get in the lift. She's got a phobia of confined spaces. And obviously their conversation, everybody was listening to them. Nobody else was talking. So I interrupted him because, look, sorry, I overheard you. I'm a hypnotherapist, and I specialise in phobia cure, and I can sort that out for you if you want. And I went through the NLP fast phobia cure whilst we were on the train before the next stop. And the upshot of it was she did go in the lift, and the phobia was gone, and everything was fine. But while I was doing the phobia, every guy who was sat in that carriage was just looking at me thinking, I want to be you. It's just so awesome. But obviously I've got a partner, so I didn't ask for phone numbers or anything. But, yeah, that was certainly an easy way to attract and impress somebody. So I really stood out there. But it was an awesome opportunity to use something that is a really valuable tool that completely transformed that person's life within a space of time where we're going from one tube station to the next. You know, what a fantastic gift that is to be able to share with a person.
And it works with quite a significant proportion of people with phobias, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does, yeah. I've never had a problem with the NLP fast phobia call. There's two versions of it. And I've been doing it for quite a long time with people one-on-one, and I've always had success. Quite recently, I did do the NLP fast phobia cure with someone over the phone who's a friend of mine who has a phobia of needles and needed to go for a blood test. Had no success whatsoever, but I think the big difference was not being there in person. So I know kind of hypnosis does work over the phone, and you can do NLP over the phone, but I think in person it's so much more powerful, and you can kind of really gauge how they're responding and how to move forward. But yeah, I was kind of upset that one didn't work out quite so well, because I really, really wanted to help this person. But unfortunately, a bit last minute and over the phone, so it wasn't quite as successful as in person.
Well, I guess that there are some people, aren't there, who are not susceptible to hypnosis, and I would imagine that when you haven't got body language and pheromone contact,
definitely,
and all that other stuff, that the number of people just kind of increases.
With the NLP fast phobia cure, if somebody happens to be an auditory person as opposed to a visual person, one of the original method wouldn't work with them, because it's all about visualization. So obviously that's a factor as well. We've got different types of people, and you have to move your therapy depending on who that person is.
Yeah. You referred in passing to a thing called the swish pattern with reference to NLP. What's that?
The swish pattern is the idea of getting one situation that you don't like and one situation that you do like, and creating images of both of those. And then, I mean, you're a DJ, you know, a crossfader.
Yep.
Yeah, this is how I see the swish pattern. It's got, you've got one record playing, the sound's coming out of that record, and you want the other record to play, so you move your crossfader across. So that's what we're doing with a swish pattern. We've got the old pattern, and then we want to zoom that one back as we zoom the new patterning forwards, and it moves us over to whatever the new one is. Now, I kind of changed the swish pattern a little bit. I like to have one of them smash through the other one and then, like, you know, just explode it to smithereens so the pieces all fly behind you. And I like the idea of doing that, like really destroying the whole pattern so that the new one becomes something that's so huge that you become saturated in it and you can jump right into that experience. I like this idea of not only progressing someone into what it is that they desire, but getting them there to a point where they can really, really feel it and really feel the emotions of it. And I think that is key to manifestation, is how much you can make it feel real to you once you've projected yourself into whatever it is you desire.
Yeah, yeah. One of the most important aspects, I gathered, is to realise it in your mind first.
Definitely, definitely. Yeah, I'd say that and the emotion of love. Something that nobody talks about to do with the law of attraction towards cosmic ordering or any of those things is when we manifest from the mind, we are manifesting in we're manifesting from duality consciousness, which is the third dimension. So we've got up, down, left, right, wrong. So we do manifest the object that we're focused on. But we also manifest its polar opposite. And that's just to do with the balance, the yin and the yang, and the nature of this universe that we live in. So it's the third dimension that causes that to happen. So we get the thing we wanted. We think, yeah, this is fantastic. It's worked out exactly how we expected. But then the opposite of that shows up, and we don't feel that we've created the opposite of it because we wasn't focused on it. Now, the trick is to manifest from the heart. You shift yourself into a fourth dimensional reality where you begin to breathe in love, and you connect to the emotion of unconditional love, and then you do the manifestation meditations from that place. And this is unity consciousness, where you are just manifesting what it is that you desire, and you see that into this reality as opposed to creating its polar opposite as well. So that I say, being in the emotional state of whatever it is you desire is very, very important for manifestation. But underlying that, you must have that feeling of unconditional love, and that connects you to the unity consciousness that means that one thing you desire comes in. And the way that I suggest that people should do this, if they have a child, then to imagine the very first time they held the child and looked into the child's eyes, and they would have died for that child, you know? So it's kind of a completely unconditional thing. Now, I haven't got kids, and I'm not very keen on them, to be honest, so that wouldn't work for me at all. If you've got kids and they're, you know, proper little, then don't do that. But what works for me is to imagine I've got a little kitten. So I imagine I'm holding a kitten up by my face, and I can feel the soft fur against my skin. I can smell the kitten. It's got little soft pads on its paws because it's not been outside yet. And perhaps there's a little squeak and its ears are a bit folded over. Now, I have unconditional love for that helpless, tiny little kitten. So that's one of the tricks that I used when I'm trying to connect with that emotion. Now, there is a physical mechanics sort of meditation that you can do as well, which is an extract of the Macabre meditation, where you just lift up an energy ball from around about your stomach area to your chest, and you imagine that you're breathing in from above you and from beneath you into that place in your chest. And when you do that, that connects you to breathing from a higher dimension. So it really does bring you into a place of unconditional love. So yeah, that is so, so important for manifestation, because if you don't do that part, but you do all the mechanics of the psychology of it, it's going to work, but you are going to get the negative stuff turn up as well. And that happened to me for a long time in my manifestations before I realized what was going on. So I mean,
that's an interesting perspective, because I'm aware that that many people, as we'll get onto later, manifest the opposite of what they're after. But the idea that we're manifesting both does actually ring some bells with me. And what you're suggesting there basically is you find something similar to the thing you're trying to visualize, which you've already experienced, so that you can draw on that experience to move yourself forward.
Well, I'm saying, I mean, what you want to be connected to is just the emotion of unconditional love. Once you've got that sorted and you stay in that place, then you connect to what it's going to feel like once you have manifested whatever it is that you desire. I mean, there might not be anything in your life that relates to that, but I mean, we have got imaginations, you know, we can do that. We can pretend that we're anybody that we want to be. We can kind of model somebody else that's already achieved it. And, you know, we can just bring that back to our present. That with most things that people want to manifest, it's quite easy to think of situations that will actually happen once you've manifested that thing. So, I mean, one of the ones that that I did with my partner, we manifested a car. And one of the things that we did during the manifestation process was to imagine showing off the car to our parents. So I imagined that I'd gone up to my parents' house and I'd parked the car on their drive and I was showing it around them. And I was quite proud that we'd manifested this car. So it was really easy to connect to those emotions because I've had those emotions before. I've kind of showed things to my parents before that I've been pleased that I've purchased. So that was an easy one to do. And another little trick that we did, the car that we was actually manifesting at the time, it was an Alfa Romeo. And we were driving around in a Citroen. And every time we saw another Alfa driver, we flashed our headlights at them as though we were part of this Alfa club. Now, obviously, they've got no clue what we're doing. We're just we're in an old Citroen flashing our headlights at them, and they don't know what's going on there. But it kind of made us feel like we were part of that club. So it made us feel much more like we were there and we were already in this car that we wanted. So, yeah, it works. I mean, those little tricks work really, really well. I kind of like things like that.
That's a pretty amazing story, the story of how you manifested the car and how exact that particular was. And I think before we get into the specifics of how you do it, perhaps it would be a good idea to have a couple of examples of how it works for you and it appears from your testimonials to other people who've read your material. Do you want to tell us the story about the car?
Yeah, sure. It's quite a long one, but I'll do the compressed version of it.
Go for it.
Well, the manifestation of the car came about, it's on my website. A couple of people will have read this already, but they won't know that the person that manifested this is actually my partner. So obviously we're going to do experiments with people closest to us. Now, this came about from this idea of hypnotizing people using NLP to get them to manifest something they wanted, like weight loss, by imagining being the ideal weight. So I said, let's try and do this on something that's external to us. So we decided to try and use kind of like hypnosis and NLP techniques to actually manifest, by the idea of the law of attraction, a new car. So my partner chose a car. She chose the Alfa Romeo Mito Veloz, which was the top spec model of their latest car at the time. She chose what paint she wanted, the alloy wheels, everything. She really did nail down exactly what she wanted to manifest. And then we went through this process of imagining that we'd already won it, how it would feel. We imagined the keys being handed over with a local newspaper. We imagined getting an unexpected phone call where she was told that she'd won this car. We went through that entire process that you'd normally do with kind of any manifestation. And then we bumped into this competition on the internet to win a lower spec, different color, but same car. And I kind of thought, this is a sign. Let's get on with this. So I entered the competition for her. It was an online rally, like playing a game where you got a race against other people. And to actually, if we was going to get any chance whatsoever of winning this race, you needed a nitrous code, and you had to go to an Alfa Romeo garage to get the code. And to get the code, you had to do like a test drive. So we went over to Solihull, that's our local Alfa garage, and we said to the guy behind the counter, says, we're here about the competition to win the car. And he was like, yeah, that's fine, fill out these forms. So we filled in these forms, we went on the test drive, and the actual test drive was in the exact car that she'd been thinking about, same paint, same alloys, everything. So he was like, kind of, is this the manifestation? So he was a little bit unsure as to whether we were going to get it.
You're just going to test drive it, and that's it.
We were thinking, are we just going to get a teaser? So we went on the test drive, got back to the garage, and we said, can we have the nitrous code? And the guy hadn't got a clue what we were talking about. We thought, this is a bit weird. You know, we've already said we're about the competition to win the car. We filled out the forms, give us the code. And nobody at the garage knew what we were talking about at all. And they had to get in touch with the head office. They found the code for us. We got the code, got back home, carried on with the competition. And there were several different heats, like different races that you had to do. And there were different prizes if you came top in different sections of the race. Now, I mean, I manifest lots of things at once. And back then, the Nintendo Wii was quite recent. That was a new thing, so I kind of wanted one of those. I'm a sucker for gadgets. And the iPod Touch just came out, so I wanted one of those as well. So that was another couple of things on my list. And we were top of the leaderboards in one of the areas on this race thing that meant that we actually won the iPod Touch. So that ticked a box for us. That was awesome. And it got towards the last day of the race. And I went to log in to race. We've got right to the top of the leaderboards, a couple of races left to go, and it really looked like we was going to win this car. And my computer wouldn't connect to the internet. So I was on the phone to Sky trying to sort it out, and they was telling me nothing was wrong. They couldn't find a problem. I went to my parents' house, tried to use their computers, and their computer couldn't connect to the website where the race was, so I couldn't do it there. I got back home. I actually reinstalled Windows, which is such a headache to do. It was driving me crazy. I was like, why is this happening today of all days? But I couldn't get back online. And then just as weirdly as I'd lost my connection, it just come back all of a sudden. And we'd got probably an hour or so, maybe a bit longer to finish off this race. And we dropped down the leaderboards. So we got back on. I raced as much as I possibly could until it felt like my eyes were burning. And we didn't win. We came in third. And third prize was the Nintendo Wii. So that was another one of the things that we wanted, but we didn't get the car. And I turned around to Nat and I was saying, I can't believe we didn't get it. We did everything right. Every time that we manifest things, they normally work. It felt like we was going to get it. What have we done wrong? We just didn't understand what we'd done wrong. And we honestly thought that the people that came in above us, you know, was going to get some sort of message that said, we found out they were cheating and you're the rightful winners. So, you know, we didn't win it. And a couple of weeks passed and we got this phone call. And I mean, that answered the phone. Her face just lit up and she come off the phone. I was like, who was that? And she's like, it was the Alpha Garage. I was like, what's going on? She goes, we've won a car. I was like, what are you talking about? And when we went to the garage and said, we're here about the competition to win the car, and he gave us the form, there were two competitions. And we didn't know anything about the other one at all. And it was just a raffle. That's all it was. And we'd filled out our details that entered us into this raffle. And that had been picked as the winner for the top prize. And the top prize was the exact car that she'd been focusing on. It was the same make, the same colour, the same spec, everything. It got the same alloy wheels, same colour paint. It was exactly what she'd focused on. Now, I mean, the reason I love that story is because we jumped about from one thing to another. It was a really crazy set of situations that led to us winning the car. But we specifically said that we wanted this this unexpected phone call. And when the phone call come through, of course it was unexpected. If we had won the car in the online rally, we'd have known about it because we'd been top of the leaderboards. And then also, I mean, the both competitions were being run by the same company, and I don't think we'd have been allowed to have both cars. So maybe losing one of them meant that we was eligible for the other one. And then, of course, when we went to collect the car, the newspaper were people there to take photographs. And I stood watching as they handed the keys over to Nat and they took the photographs. And it was exactly the way I'd visualized it. And then obviously we took the car around to my parents and we showed them then. And everything was exactly how we'd seen it in our minds playing out. It was just so awesome. And the thing was so specific. But what gets me, if anybody else would have come to me and said, I want to manifest a car and told me they wanted this specific car, the first thing I'd tell them to do is get yourself on a test drive, because that will enable you to feel what it's like to be in that car. Get on a test drive, savor it, pretend it's yours, ignore the sales guy in the back trying to sell it to you, and just pretend it's your car and then take that experience with you, because that's what's going to make you win it. So, I mean, we didn't do a test drive until we were forced to do one by this kind of online competition so that we get this nitrous code for the race. So it was such a weird set of synchronicities that led to something that really was just a raffle. And it was, I mean, the raffle would have been so easy. Fill out your name, win exactly what you asked for, as opposed to me staying up every night trying to do this race. So
I think you're just trying to prove by your performance you're exactly the sort of man who needs an Alfa Romeo.
Yeah, well, that's what it was. No, it was her car. It wasn't mine. So it's, but yeah, it was a brilliant car. But the thing I'd never tell people about that story is we manifested that from the head, not from the heart. And we only got to keep it for 6 months. So
what happened to it then?
We had to give it back. So the competition was to win it for 6 months. Now, I mean, I've told this story a few times. I've told it on YouTube and things like that. But I didn't tell people that we had to give it back because, I mean, we did get what we asked for. We won it. We had the experience of winning it exactly the way that we wanted to. So we did really manifest what we were focused on. But we also manifested the polar opposite, having to give away this very specific car after having it for 6 months. And that's because we're manifesting from the mind. So it's all down to where you are. If you're in this place of love, then that's what you're going to do. Now, I put that story up on YouTube explaining to people how you manifest like this, not realizing that you needed to be in the emotion of love. And I got so much feedback from people saying, I've gone through this process. I have won a car, but I crashed it on the way home. All these crazy stories coming back. I was thinking, oh, my God, I'm going to have to take it down. But, I mean, when I realized what was going on, and then I started to apply that to the things that I manifested into my life, then we started to get those things, and they were just awesome. They were exactly what we were looking for. And, I mean, it didn't go tits up. I kind of call it order flipping. It's kind of you get it, but then it flips on you. You either have to give it back or it goes wrong, or, you know, it's something turns a 180 on you that means that you've now manifested exactly what you didn't want. And, I mean, it could be you manifest a lot of money, and then you go gambling and lose it all. You still manifested the money, but you also manifested the polar opposite. And that's what keeps the balance in this reality. And that's what I used to do for quite a long time. Now, when you're manifesting small things, like you know, an extra few quid for the month or a car park space or something like that, it's no big deal if you manifest the opposite. When you start manifesting really big things, the polar opposite is pretty scary. So that's why you really got to get on board with this this connecting to the heart and being in this place of love.
And was it the kind of meditation that taught you how to get in touch with what you called unity consciousness earlier on?
Yeah, absolutely. It was, for me, it was the Flower of Life workshop and learning the Macabre meditation, because you've got to be in that place of love to do that meditation, otherwise the Macabre doesn't work at all. So I kind of extracted a bit of that meditation, which is what I teach people now when I'm, well, if I'm working with someone to do the Law of Attraction, I'll just use a small snippet of that, because it is an incredibly complicated meditation, but there's a small part of that which enables you to shift your breathing from this reality up to another dimension, and that and being in that place of unconditional love above anything else, that is the most important. And I mean, if you've got anything in your life where you felt unconditional love, just saturate yourself in that memory and really bring it close, make it bright, make it colorful, hear the sounds that you heard, feel how you felt, the smells that were there, whatever it was that you experienced at that time. If you can bring that back and just sit in that emotion till you get to the point where you feel unconditional love, then you focus on your desire and you focus on it in such a way that it already feels as though it's yours. And you think about an event that's going to take place once it has happened, like you're showing it off to your family, for instance, then that's manifestation mastery. That's where that's the place where we've got to get to.
Yeah. Yeah, indeed. We had, just to return, we had a quick question about hypnotism in the chat box, which I'd like to catch just before it runs away from me. It's from Lee, and he says, is hypnotism still a form of mind control? Can it ever be used positively when you're in placing an illusion to get a goal? Is that really free will and self-will?
Oh, there's no such thing as free will, really, is there? I mean, the reason that I might have someone come to me for hypnosis is because that person has been hypnotized by society, peer pressure, movies that they've watched into being something they don't want to be. So I can then manipulate them in a more positive way to get them to be something they do want to be. Let's take smoking for an example, okay? A lot of people started smoking because peer pressure, you look cool, and there are films where the villain, who's this really cool gangster character, smokes. And we associate with that when we're growing up, we're 14, 15 years old, and we want to look cool, we want to look big. So we are hypnotized into becoming something that we don't want to be, that is not good for us. Now, if I can then do something, I don't care if someone thinks it's positive, negative, mind control or whatever, I'm only focused on the outcome. I don't care about the techniques that I use to get to that outcome. If I can achieve that person's desire and I can help them to get to a place where they want to be, and we're not talking about an illusion, we're talking about changing something so it can never be how it was again. If you think about the way that I see phobias is we have a stimulus, it might be a dog, it might be the dark, heights, whatever that thing is, and we've got fear. And those two things have been connected together in your brain. So every time you see the one thing, it triggers the fear. And that's like an old vinyl record playing. The needle's in the groove and it keeps on playing. And the more times it plays, the deeper that groove gets. What a hypnotist does is we come along and we scratch the hell out of that record so it cannot play the same again. And then we take that same stimulus and we connect it to something else. So we might connect it to pleasure or indifference or whatever it might be. Now, I really don't care what people think of me. I really don't care what people think of the techniques that I use, but I really, really do care about the outcome and about helping people to get to the point where they want to be. So, I mean, whether it's manipulation or not, it's neither here or there.
So to a certain...
the focus is get the result.
Yeah, to a certain extent, it's deconditioning, isn't it? To allow
I mean, people have been hypnotized. I mean, we are not born with a lack of self-confidence. You know, we're not born with... We kind of have a couple of fears when we're born. We kind of have heights and, you know, loud noises maybe. But, I mean, we learn things. I mean, one of my biggest fears for a long time was public speaking. Now, that is for specifically for the kind of person I am. That's a problem. So that means if I'm ever going to get up on stage in front of people and share information that hopefully will better their lives, I've got to overcome this fear of public speaking. But where did that come from? I didn't have it from birth. It came from having to get up, talk about things I'm not interested in school, and being belittled by teachers so that I feel like I'm worthless. So then from that point forwards, I find it difficult to get up in front of people. So I need to undo that conditioning so I can get up in front of someone and feel awesome, feel confident, and feel like I'm going to share something that's going to better someone's life.
And do you think that, I mean, basically, Lee just put in the chat box, he finds all these this talk of unconditional love very difficult. New Age, he refers to it as, because here we are surrounded by war. My own feeling on that is that every individual difference we can make towards the beneficial is actually helping the general pot, as it were.
Oh, God, yes. Yeah. I think if you're kind of worried about what's going on out there in the world and that's stopping you from having an emotion in your body, then that's something that needs to be addressed. It's you can choose how you want to feel at any time. You can choose what you want to focus on at any time. Stick a comedy on, watch something that makes you laugh, just go and pet a cat for a while, just have a cat sat on your lap, stroke it and listen to its purr, watch a dog wagging its tail. You know, just remove yourself from all that negative bombardment that's going on out there and just focus on something else. It's still going to be there. If you don't pay attention to it for a while, it's not going to make it, you know, that's not going to be a problem. But once you've, you know, feel unconditional love for a bit and then get back to that if you want to, or just ignore it. You know, it's, to me, that kind of, it's going on. And I'm a firm believer in when we focus on something, we give it energy. And if we focus on something going on in the world, it doesn't matter what it is. If we feel emotions while we're doing that, we are giving it energy. So, I mean, I think it's a much better idea to shift our focus towards things that are good, that are going on in the world, and that we want to create more of and give that our energy. So your energy is a really powerful thing. Don't go wasting it on things like wars. You know, think about things that would be really nice to increase in the world and focus on those things. But if a person is having difficulty getting to a state of unconditional love because they're worried about what's going on in the world, then just bring it back home a little bit and just think about something, you know, even something really, really small that's important to you. So shut out the outside world for a bit. And it's kind of, there's a meditation trick where you take all of your thoughts, your feelings, your emotions, all that stuff, and you kind of imagine that you're putting them in a box and you lock the box and all the stuff's in there. So when you finish your meditation, you can come and get it back. So you're not worried about forgetting it and you don't have to think about things. Put it in a safe box, metaphorically, of course, and then go and do your little meditation. And once you've finished, go and get the stuff out of the box. And when you're getting it out of the box, if you take some things out and you think, well, I don't really want this, it's doing me no good, leave it in the box. You know, I think that's a much better way of changing your own state. It's just to think of the small things, just something that makes you smile, doesn't matter what it is. And just focus on those things.
I think here's Lee again saying, no, patting my dog won't make the negative usury and banking problems go away, no matter how much I pray or surround myself in the rainbow. Well, I think I'd take a bit of issue with that, because that is, I mean, we know about the usury and we do hear an awful lot of that going on. But that is, one of the things I'd say is that there's some... manifestation technique is what we're all doing all the time, but most of us are asleep at the wheel, and that's why we've got the usury and all of that.
You're bang on. That's bang on. The problem is, if one person focuses on unconditional love, then it does have an effect, but one person's not enough. We need to hit a point of critical mass, and when enough people are focusing on this thing, we'll just change. It will just change completely. The way that I look at this, if you imagine that you've got a blanket And on the blanket, there's lots and lots of little dots. And each one of those dots represents a person that's alive at the moment in the world. And the dot in the middle is you. And you imagine that you pinch the blanket at the dot that represents you and you lift it up. And that's you increasing your spiritual vibration. So that's you focusing on positivity, becoming a more spiritual person. Your energy is affecting people around you. And as you lift up that blanket and it tents around you, the small dots that are close by, they get lifted up as well. Now, it doesn't take many people to work on their own spiritual growth to be picked up in different places of this blanket for the entire blanket to lift up. And when we hit that magic number, that will be critical mass. And at that point, there won't be war. Everything will shift. Everything will change. Because that has such a tremendous power. It's like everything that's external to us is of our creation. But it's not just one person's creation. We are creating en masse. The entire population of this planet is creating the state the planet's in at the moment. The good stuff, the bad stuff, everything. Now, there's some people that are incredibly positively focused, and their experience of the world is an awesome experience. They're having a fantastic time. The people that are within the, the people that are paying attention to the wars and all that kind of stuff, they might think that that is everybody's experience of the way the world is at the moment, but it isn't. Some people are removed from that and just having a wonderful experience of life. And when enough people are vibrating at a frequency which is high enough, then that will transform humanity. It will transform the planet. I mean, the planet is a living being and responds incredibly to our love and our emotion. And we just need to hit a point where we all shift. I mean, this is one of the reasons why I'm into the law of attraction. We are approaching a period of ascension where we do become fourth dimensional beings. And when we do that, we're going to be manifesting things instantly. There's not going to be a time lag like we have today. And that time lag kind of protects us from our own inability to focus on what it is we desire. When that's gone, for some people, it's going to be like heaven on earth. And for some people, it's going to be like hell on earth, because we're going to manifest whatever's inside our minds. And it's all going to be pretty instant. So
it's going to come as a bit of a shock to some people, I suspect.
Yeah, definitely. It will do. So I kind of think that doing this stuff, manifesting the little things, the material things that a lot of people think might not be right or it might be greedy, to me, that's like learning the alphabet. It's learning fundamental techniques that are going to be so important later. And then a bit later, we can learn to string words together and then have intelligent conversations. So we can manifest things like a parking space, a little bit more money, a holiday, a house, or whatever it might be. And we can also manifest things like the next step in our spiritual growth, or the person that's going to bring a message to us that's going to enable us to enlighten ourselves in some way, you know, and to be able to share that with other people. To me, this is the real power of the law of attraction, is to be able to move yourself along your spiritual path. It's like we're all spiritual beings of light that have come down here onto earth to have a physical human experience. So let's enjoy that experience. Let's use these tools that we've got to be able to manifest what we desire to move forward. You know, we're kind of like the fingertips of God, really, experiencing and creating reality as we move forward. And that experience, I mean, there's good and bad in that, but that's just subjective. It's the way we perceive it. It's just experience. But I think it's so, so important for us to kind of be focused on what it is that makes us feel good, and then move into that, and then pick something else that makes you feel good and move into that. It starts off being cars, but it gets to a point where it's just things that are so heartwarming to you. And that's where I want people to get to. And I think we're getting there.
I think that one of the important recognitions I've had over the last 10 or 15 years, and I'm sure Lee would probably call this new age bunkum as well, is that really the only thing I've got to offer the world, the only thing I can offer the world, is my own personal transformation. And bit by bit, I mean, without along the lines
what
that
awesome you've gift.
Yeah, and the thing is that your best hope for transforming the rest of it is to transform yourself.
Yeah, definitely. Absolutely. It all starts at home. You have to focus on yourself. There's no point in just focusing on other people if you've got to sort yourself out first. Absolutely. That is so, so important. I mean, ultimately, there is only one of us. You know, we all go back to the same source. And if we are in this illusion of being individual, separate beings, and we are trying to sort out other people that are separate from ourselves, what is that saying about our perception of who we truly are? You know, just get back to source, connect to the heart, and heal that place.
Yeah.
And that's all there is.
Yeah, indeed. And then, of course, there's the business of when you get a field full of people who are at least actively following these kind of paths and I'm with you, really. I spend as little possible, little time as I possibly can, focusing on the information that's coming out of the mass media, because I feel I'm kind of basically pouring fuel on the fire. Because if the cosmos is not just matter and energy, but is matter energy as formed by consciousness, then where you put your consciousness is really crucial.
It is so important.
I should point out that Lee does do a show on People's Internet Radio called The Dark Side of the Room.
But I do think there's value in that. You know, when we said earlier about being in first gear of the car and the motivation, the being hit with a stick. Now, you can dangle a carrot in front of a donkey forever. If it's not hungry, it's not going to move. But if you hit it with a stick, it will shift. You know, negative focus does cause you to get moving, and that's important. But the problem is, you don't want to stay in first gear because you're going to burn out your engine. So I do think there is value in being aware that there are things that are wrong, because that gets people shifted and that gets people taking action. But I think once they've started to move, take action and give focus and use your energy in the direction of how you would prefer it to be. And, you know, focus on what is right and then do more towards that. Don't just keep focused on what is wrong and moaning and bitching about it, because that's just burning out the engine in first gear. It's just kind of, and it's not nice either. It's not a pleasant experience.
No, I think that's
generally you know, the Esther and Jerry Hicks, the Abraham Hicks material, they talk about like a compass, where they're saying, if it feels good, if your emotions are good, then you are doing something right. Keep on doing it. If your emotions are bad, then what you're doing is manifesting the very thing that you don't want. So if that's anger against someone that's doing something you don't like, you are manifesting that very thing. You're fueling the fire. Now, obviously, I do think there's value in looking at the negative stuff to get you moving, but then as quickly as possible, shift your focus towards what makes you feel good. And the better you feel, the faster you are moving in that direction towards what you desire.
Yeah, indeed. And there's a couple of things that came to me there. One is that a friend of mine says that to a certain extent, we have to be aware of what's going on, of the nature of the problem, in order more effectively to embody a solution.
I think a while ago I would have said yes to that, but now I'm really not all that sure. It's like, I am focused on my spiritual growth. I meditate a lot, and I set up situations where I meet people that are going to give me my next lesson so that I can progress as a spiritual being, having a human experience. And that's really important to me. Now, at no point do I need to turn on the news and hear a load of nonsense about whatever's going on in some part of the world that's completely alien to me, to be honest, in order for me to be able to focus on my spiritual growth. I just focus on my spiritual growth, you know? So if I think there's a place for it. I think if you think about people in society that are just going to work, coming home, sticking on the TV, you know, trancing out to it until it's bedtime, getting up in the morning, going to work and doing the same thing, and then once a week they're escaping from this reality by just getting a bit drunk at the weekend. Now, if that is your experience of reality, then maybe if someone comes along and says, hey, look at what is really going on, it's going to shock you and wake you up. And once that has shocked you and that has woken you up, then start focusing on the things and moving in the positive direction.
But fundamentally, what wakes people up is not looking at all of the background noise. It is when the man comes knocking on their door. That's what wakes people up, is personal experience.
Yeah, that's true. It's so removed. Yeah, definitely. It's got to be personal, and it's got to be close to home. Otherwise, people, I mean, they really couldn't give a stuff, could they? Unless it's affecting them directly. I think a lot of people don't generally care. But again, we are conditioned not to care by the media, by watching films and having that drip feeding into our subconscious all of the time. You know, we get desensitized.
Yeah, it does strike me, though, that the people that are nominally responsible, you know, for all of these difficult messages we're getting from the mass media and all of the subliminals and all of that, to a certain extent, they're playing a pretty critical role in the transformation that you were talking about. If we're going to fully find ourselves in the third dimension instead of in the second dimension of duality that we seem to be in at the moment, then a degree of encouragement from behind, somebody waving the stick, as it were. I just wish there were some guys out there with some carrots.
But, I mean, there's a story in the Conversations with God books by Neil Donald Walsh, and it's two souls that are sitting up in heaven, two spirits, and they're about to reincarnate as humans. And one of them says to the other one, what are you going to do this time? What are you going to learn? And they says, well, what I'd really love to do is to learn forgiveness. So the other one says, I'll tell you what then, we'll both be born into humans, we'll be friends, and I'll do something to you that's really bad so that you can forgive me for it. And the first one says, God, would you do that for me? That's amazing, thank you so much. Then they're born into people, and one of them remembers their job, as in to do the bad thing, but the other one doesn't remember their job, which was to do the forgiveness. So in a lot of situations, something negative can happen that can bring about a human emotional experience that is an incredibly good thing. I mean, look how people come together after a natural disaster. It's amazing. It's like, I don't even know, apart from my direct next door neighbor, I don't know the name of anybody else that lives on my street. But I bet you if we had a natural disaster, that would change pretty quickly. You know, we'd all muck in together and we'd all play our little parts and we'd get this human sort of, just the human nature, the way it should be, would be accelerated to such an extent just because we've had the natural disaster. So, you know, there's definitely good can come out of bad situations. Definitely.
I think that's one of the things that we need to learn is at the moment, I think you're right, we do come together really nicely when we're under stress. It would be really great if we could start learning to come together at other times. Because, you know, it's an experience that I really enjoy is just spending a weekend or a week or so in a field with a bunch of people of like mind.
Roll on July, that's what we've got, isn't it? It's going to be awesome.
It is, I think, just sort of genuinely chilling and sharing information and sharing, if you like,
bringing in UFOs. That's what's going to be awesome.
Well, I'm really looking.
I'm excited about doing my talk. I'm excited about meeting the people there. But Audrey Davis, we've had a little bit of a chat on Facebook, and some of the stuff that she's doing looks amazing. And Didge has said to me that I'm going to help facilitate. I don't know what I'm going to do. Apparently I'm going to help facilitate her, but I am so excited about this. I really am.
Well, hopefully at some point Audrey might join us on the show as well. I'm quite looking forward to that. I thought
we might
have a bit of a music break before getting into the techniques you use and maybe a bit more examples of, because one of the reasons why I've been quite excited about talking to you is I've been looking into the manifestation techniques for many years. Mm-hmm. And I know other people who use them and use them incredibly successfully and not only for transforming their own lives, but for transforming the lives of people around them as well. So I personally recognize it as a valid technique. And like I say, I feel that we're doing it all the time anyway, but I.
Yeah, definitely.
And I think more and more people are evidently waking up to, I mean, just by changing our minds about how we want to treat the world, like you were talking about anger earlier, and I know some people who think that that anger fully and unreservedly expressed is useful. My own observation is that it seldom works as well as peacefulness.
At a time and a place.
Yeah.
I think if you're in a place of apathy, you know, where there's just nothing going on, no emotion, it's just utter despair and you're close to suicide, anger's a really good step in the right direction. But when you get to anger, move on to something else. You know, maybe blame comes next or something like that. But eventually get back up into those positive emotions. But, I mean, if it feels good or if it feels better than how you did feel, then that's good. And sometimes anger can feel better than how you did feel. But I imagine that there aren't many situations where anger feels better than unconditional love or joy or peace or any of those things.
It's never really worked very well for me, I must admit. I did used to be quite an angry individual, and on the odd I did spend most of my time talking quietly to people even in those days. But when I did lose my temper, it for me anyway, my experience of it was that it always made the situation much more difficult to deal with and meant there was a lot more repair work to be done further down the line.
Yeah, definitely. And I think when, I don't know if you've noticed, but when people do get angry at one another and there's an argument breaks out, no one ever says, actually, yeah, you're right. Even if they think the other person's right, because there's conflict, you've locked horns, and it's the wrong place for that kind of situation to be resolved. But if people are in a place of love and they're just having a conversation about something, then your ideas can change. And, you know, you can have someone suggest something that's so far removed from what you did believe that it completely changes your outlook. And you're like, yeah, you've got a really good point there. And then you move forward. But if you're having a bit of an argument based in anger, even if you do think the other person is right, you're not going to admit it, are you? you want to win the argument. So
that's why I think that's why I eventually developed the technique that I have, which is when I feel that a situation is getting out of hand, and some people are very angry and they'll just jump out the hedgerow and have a go at you. My my tendency nowadays is to leave it an hour or two or maybe till later in the day and then go and try and sort it out. And I found that that has unfailingly worked for me. Then by then the other person, all the chemicals that are rushing through their system and whatever it is that's happened to them to make them do that is kind of in the past. They're a bit calmer. They've maybe had a bit of time to think about it. And I found for me, again, it works unfailingly that then you can have a quieter conversation about it and stuff can be sorted out without any lasting recrimination. Because that's the other thing about anger, is that sometimes you can alienate people for a very long time.
Well, actually, I mean, after the break, remind me to tell you a story about when I was bullied at school, because you've just hit on something there that's really, really important when we're talking about things from an energetic level. So there is something I want to share with you there.
Okay. So. Well, just before we go for a music break, I'll just read this bit that Dot put in, because I really like it. It's put, whenever I used to go for a drink and when I had to use the urinal, I used to sing a Ramones song to myself, to the tiles in front of me, quietly and to myself. Then one day out of absolutely nowhere, I was the singer in a Ramones tribute band.
Awesome. That's awesome.
It kind of shows how it works, doesn't it?
Yeah, definitely.
So thanks very much for that, Steve. What I'll do is I'll put on a couple of tracks. Unfortunately, I've not been flash enough to line up a Ramones track as a result of that quote. So
that would have been
so
pretty sweet.
They're going to have to put up with Psy Power from the Hawklords instead. And we'll have 10 minutes or so of music and then come back and look a bit more at how it's worked for you and how you suggest we make it work for us.
Yes. Yeah, I look forward to it.
So you've been listening to Stephen Hall and Dr. Rock chatting about hypnotism and NLP and the rest, and we'll get on to manifestation in a moment. But here come the Hawklords, and we'll see you in 10 minutes or so. There you go, Catatonia there, and Strange Glue off their International Velvet album, which everybody out there must know that I really like. And this evening we're talking to Steve Hall about manifestation techniques, because he's going to be presenting with me and Synchro and Clive DeCarl and various other people at the Conscious Tribal Gathering. And Luigi, whilst we were having a bit of a music break there, asked me to let people know that anybody who wants to come along, if they bring some instruments and stuff, there will be fireside music in the evening. And regular listeners will also know that I'm extremely keen on that. I believe that when we entertain ourselves with our own skills and our own music and things like that, we're getting much, much better entertainment than I experience anywhere else. I don't know, have you got any experience of that sort of thing, doing your own cabaret, Steve?
Well, you've not heard me play music. It's not entertaining at all. In the confines of my house without any audience, it's not too bad.
Well,
I used to play the guitar, and I was in a band, but we never performed anywhere. But we had like three guitarists and no drummer, so I switched over to the drums. Now the drums are awesome. You can just kind of just dance in with your drum kit, and it's so much more fun. If you make a mistake, nobody notices. So
you took to drumming. It's quite a complex job.
I love it. Once you get your head around the rhythm of being able to do, you know, the patting the top of your head and rubbing your belly.
Yeah.
Once you can do that, it's not bad at all. But as it goes, I've just started learning the piano as well. So my partner, she's grade 5. She plays classical piano. So we do have a piano at home. So I thought it would be such a waste not to use it. So I'm kind of learning how to play that as well now.
Piano is a really rewarding instrument to play, I think.
Yeah, it is. It's really pleasing. I mean, you're sitting in the vibration of it. As it goes, it needs retuning. And I don't know how much you know about the frequencies of like concert pitch for A. If it being 440 hertz as opposed to 444 hertz, the difference in that. So I kind of want it to be retuned so that it's in harmony with our human aura, and then when you're playing music, it's like a real full-on meditation.
Yeah,
so
I think
I'm looking forward to that.
That's a really good idea. I'd like to. Because I had a chat with Tim Wheater sometime middle of last year, and he plays and composes music in the proper pitch rather than the modified one.
It's 432, isn't it?
That's it. 432 and 440. I think.
And it's currently 440. And they kind of shifted it some time ago. But yeah, get it down to 432. It's only, you know, it's not really going to make much of a difference to the sound of the music, but the vibration of the frequencies in your body is phenomenal.
Yeah, it was Goebbels. It was Goebbels that changed it, apparently. I was really surprised to find that this was a message that came out of the Second World War. And
yeah, it's like the fluoride story, isn't it, all over again?
Yeah.
All those things that condition us all seem to come from the same place. So.
They certainly do, but that place's time is extremely limited at this stage in the game, I would say.
Oh, yes. Yes, very much so.
I think partly because I mean, it's not just your techniques, manifestation techniques, it's meditation, it's all kinds of spiritual and awakening work that's going on out there.
It's people coming into their own power, isn't it? In whichever way that manifests for a person, whatever they choose as their thing, it's people reclaiming their power. And I think that's so, so valuable.
Fundamentally, I think that's synonymous with reassuming responsibility, basically.
Yeah, definitely. That comes into play as well. And see that thing with the where there's blame, there's a claim. It's kind of that idea just takes the responsibility away from us. And at the same time, it takes the power away from us. So it's a double-edged sword. We really, really do need to take responsibility for what's going on. And then we can have the power to change what's going on and make it better.
Yes. Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And we're the only ones to do it as well.
Well, me and a few friends.
Well, that's what I mean.
A little bit of a help from
all of us who are down here vibrating at the moment, because another thing I like to keep in mind is that we talk glibly about spirit and matter, but actually we now know it's nearly all space and frequency. It's very difficult to slip a Rizzler between the two things. So we are both physical and spiritual, quite clearly.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. There's no way that you can really separate that. And I think once you take that essence of what is the spiritual part of us away, I mean, you're really just a zombie, aren't you? It's just, it's to me, it's kind of, I always perceive the idea of kind of having a body and being in this body at the moment a bit like having a car. And if my car gets a bit rusty and needs to be scrapped, I'll go and get a better one. And I'm not really bothered about getting a better one. The me that's driving it in the driving seat, that doesn't change. And we just keep on going through these different experiences.
Yeah. So what about this bully story you were talking
about?
Bully
story. Yeah. It sounds much worse than it is. This was middle school, so I'm around about, I don't know, 11, 12 years old, something like that. And there was a lad that he kind of bullied me, but I don't think he even knew that he bullied me. But it was a little bit intimidating. And, it was a bit of teasing going on and that kind of stuff. He wasn't a friend. We were in the same class for a couple of our lessons. And I didn't really have all that much to do with him. But years and years later, I was doing a meditation. And the meditation was about disconnecting yourself from the energy that you are still exchanging with people that have been a part of your life. And I thought to myself, who's affected me in a negative way? And I kind of really did struggle. So I've had a pretty easy life, to be honest. But I come up with this one guy from middle school. I thought, he used to intimidate me. I'm going to do the meditation on him. It's quite late at night. I'm lying in my bed doing this meditation. And I was imagining that there was energy going from my solar plexus to his. And I imagined it like a big pipe. And, like a big gas pipe, you know, there's couplings where you'd have to turn it and it'd clunk and then you can disconnect it.
You're really good at this this visualizing game, aren't you?
Yeah. Well, I kind of imagined it was one of those things. And I disconnected it from me like a real satisfying clunk. And I took this pipe thing off me. And I imagined doing the same at his end, at the other guy's end. And then I used visualization to kind of dissolve that pipeline between us away. And once it had gone, I was aware that I had this big kind of like wound in my front at my solar plexus, and it needed to be healed. So I imagined that I was healing it, and I was kind of nurturing it and giving it love, and it's all visualization and techniques. And then I took my awareness to the same thing on the other guy, and he'd got this kind of wound as well, where I'd removed this energy thing from us both. So I did the same thing with him. I just imagined that I was kind of healing it with my hands. I didn't really know what I was doing, but I just imagined that I was giving it a bit of love and, healing up this hole and sealing it and it all being all nice. Didn't really think anything else of it. Went to sleep, woke up in the morning, and I had a message from the guy. And this is 25 years after I'd last spoke to him. We were never friends. And he said he'd found me out and he'd sent me a message to apologise for the way he treated me at school. Oh, I just couldn't believe it. It's just, made me think.
That's 25 years down the line.
Yeah, it's got to be 25, maybe. So what was this? I was 12, maybe 12 years. Yeah, it's got to be about 25 years. And straight out of the blue, got an email from him the next day. And I was thinking to myself, what I've just done was a healing for me and the healing for him. I've just released the guilt from that experience of him. That's kind of like going to be a weight off his shoulders that he didn't realize he was carrying for all this time. So I started trying to think of all these people that have wronged me, even just a tiny little bit. And I was doing this kind of uncoupling manifestation, meditation on everybody I could think of. I kind of wanted to think of people that had been a negative influence in my life. Now, really strangely, There was one guy who I just didn't really like him when we were little. He kind of did intimidate me a little bit, but he very often featured in dreams as a negative character in my dreams. So I did the meditation on him as well. And his role within my dreams changed. Now, he didn't get in touch with me or anything like that. I've never spoken to him since. But yeah, he became a different character that had different meaning within my dreams. It was a really strange experience. But it just goes to show how doing something on yourself can have an effect on somebody else and on someone else and the external world and things like that. And I know that we were directly connected by that energy, but it had such a big impact for the guy to feel it and interconnect to me.
I should imagine your psychology degree probably revealed a few very good experiments that have shown that really there is no distance between us in terms of subconsciousness.
I didn't go as far as a degree.
The A level. Yeah, I would. That's
yeah,
why
an A level really isn't that much in psychology.
That's what I meant.
I used to stay back afterwards, and me and the psychology lecturer would have big long talks into the night. So that side of it was awesome, but they were kind of teaching things that I thought were out of date. So
I was a guinea pig for the psychology A level. I did it in its first year of inception, and I must admit I really enjoyed it. Of all of the exams and all of the studies I did when I was in the small prisoner of war camp known as school, the psychology revealed more stuff to me that I still use to this day, and I still have a huge interest in, because nowadays the experiments and investigations into consciousness and precognition and far seeing and one individual with a photo of another individual can sit in a laboratory on one side of the world and depress that person's autonomic nervous system just by looking
at
a photograph.
There's a book called Mind Trek.
That sounds good.
It's by Joseph McMonagall or something, I think.
Yeah.
But that's very military organised, and it's all about the remote viewing. That's an awesome introduction to that subject. It really is.
Again, I've come across people who really don't believe that that remote viewing actually occurs, but my reading on the subject suggests it definitely does.
Oh, absolutely. It definitely does. I've had a couple of friends experience teleportation as well. And, I made a YouTube video explaining a couple of the experiences that I'd heard from my parents experienced teleportation, and also one of my friends did. And I didn't know my friend had until I told him the story about my parents. And then he was like, God, that's happened to me. I made a video about it. I put it on YouTube, and I had so many people come back saying, this has happened to me as well, but I just didn't think anyone else had experienced it. So I think all that phenomena, you know, whether it's remote viewing, teleportation, telekinesis or whatever, there are so many people out there that are having these experiences, but they're not sharing them. So they're not realizing how commonplace they are.
That's because they quite often get ridiculed if they do.
I get ridiculed a lot. Yeah. I really don't care. If someone calls me weird, I consider it a real nice compliment. I don't mind.
If I was going
a long time ago, I used to care what people thought, but these days.
Yeah, I mean, if I was to get worried about the number of people who think that I'm weird, and even worse, the number of people who think that I'm just wrong, then I'd never go out the front door, probably.
Yeah, exactly. But no, it's working for me. So I don't mind, and I'm not going to try and impose my views upon someone. People can listen to me if they want to, and then it's up to them whether they want to take it, but I'm not going to try and shove it down anyone's throat.
Exactly.
But, it works well for me, so I'm happy to believe it. So.
Yeah, and I fortunately know just as many people who are simply as crazy as I am, probably.
That's good, though, isn't it? Makes for an interesting late-night conversation.
Well, you know, looking at the general definition of sanity that seems to be abroad nowadays, I'd rather be crazy by quite a long chalk.
Actually, that was a thing in the psychology. Every time we did a bell curve as what was normal and what wasn't, and we'd go through all these different tests, I was always right on the fringes of the bell. I thought, I'm not giving this in, they'll section me. But actually, as it goes, when I did my psychology A-level exams, I did all the studying that you have to do. And the night before the exam, I was watching a TV program that was to do with the relationship between nature and nurture. And it was some experiment that some psychologists had done recently. And it was a really fascinating program. And the next day on my exam question was exactly about that same subject. So I ignored all the stuff I'd studied, and I pretty much wrote down the TV program that I'd watched the night before when I should have been studying, and I got 100% in an essay exam. I was like, how lucky was that? Yeah, just watching telly.
So what you want to be doing is writing down the stuff they don't teach you, and that might work for you.
I think that's what impressed them. I think it was a case of they thought, this guy's gone so outside the box, he must have an interest in this subject and study it in his own time, because this is not on the curriculum. Whereas really, I'd just just been slacking off and watching telly, and it just happened to be exactly what my question was on. So, yeah, really fortunate situation there. If it was a different question, I'd have probably failed.
Oh, Nick Nomix put in the chat box, he's put, teleportation and remote viewing must exist for mainstream to co-opt those memes and make things like Star Trek credible.
Well, I can tell you the story, if you like, the teleportation story.
Go on, then. I don't think I've met anybody who's teleported before.
Well, I've not teleported, but my dad did. I don't know whether he'll like me sharing this, but he's in Vegas at the moment, so he's not listening, so I don't care. Right? This happened when my sister was a little baby, and I'm 41. My sister's 45, I think, 44, something like that. So this was when she was kind of, you know, about like 6 months old. My dad had carried her to the car. He'd put her on the seat in the car, and he'd left the door open, and he'd gone back to the house because he'd forgotten something. So you've got the car parked on the road, and then you've got the pathway, then the garden fence, the garden, and the house. And he's leant, the window's open in the house, and he's leant on the windowsill, talking to my mum, telling my mum that he's forgot something, and she's getting it for him. And as he's waiting for it, he looks back over his shoulder, and my sister had fallen out of the car. She's in midair, about to hit her head on the floor. And he just spun round and put his hands out, and he caught her. And there was, obviously there's no way he could have made that distance and done that. And, I mean, they never told me about that, but I was reading a book and it got this story about teleportation in it. And I was like, wow, listen to this. And I told them the story and my parents both went white. And my mum looked at my dad, I was like, what's going on? And she went, that's what you did. And then they told me this story about this teleporting to catch my sister. Now, obviously the bond between a dad and her, you know, the firstborn, that's going to be pretty strong. So this is reason to bend the rules of physics a little. So I told one of my friends about this story. And he goes, that's happened to me. And I was like, go on then. And he'd been to his parents' house, and he was just leaving. He got back in the car, and his mum and his sister were stood in the doorway of the house waving goodbye, and he's in the car in the driving seat, and he saw his dad at the top of the stairs starting to topple down the stairs. And he, quick as a flash, he went out the car, past the people in the doorway, even though they were blocking the doorway, up the stairs and caught his dad, all in a split second. But he can actually remember moving, but he says he was, you know when you see like a vampire movie and they move lightning fast? That's how he experienced it. It was like a split second, but he was aware of the journey from the car, you know, out of the car, down the drive, up the stairs, and he caught his dad just as he was toppling from the top of the stairs. But, I mean, I told those two stories on a YouTube video, and so many people left comments saying, I've done something similar. It was so awesome. So I want to do it.
Yeah. I think that's very interesting, because that's the first time I've heard of that happening. Mm. But I am aware that, you know, under some circumstances, mothers have been known to lift a car off a baby.
And superhuman.
I believe. I saw some clip on YouTube at some stage of somebody actually wrestling a helicopter that had kind of landed in a ditch on top of somebody.
Jesus Christ.
Well, yeah, and those are known to be physically impossible tasks.
Yeah,
and
I suspect it's
one of those indications of how we've somehow become caged, that we can actually do a lot more than we believe we can. And
ultimately, we are all that is, aren't we? We are a manifestation of an aspect of consciousness that creates everything that exists. Therefore, everything is available to us. We are all information that has ever been, ever will be, is within our heart if we can access the sacred place in our heart and get to it. And we can also be whatever we want to be. But there's kind of rules, but rules can be broken and rules can be bent. But it has to be, you know, the circumstances have to be, there's got to be the motivation there to want to do it. And also, I think that there's probably some kind of permission that needs to be granted in order for us to do this, as opposed to everybody just, you know, teleporting around willy-nilly as they want. But it'd be pretty good for, commuting, wouldn't it? Teleport to work.
And all sorts of other things. I mean, the thing is that I would have thought that by and large, if you can move yourself from the car to the top of the stairs, then you can move yourself to wherever and whenever you like.
Yeah, I mean, there's a... I can't remember what this comes from. It might be in that Mind Trek book, but it's a woman who does the remote viewing, and she reads a serial number off a satellite, and then she watches them crash the satellite into Jupiter. I mean, obviously, after she'd read the serial number off the satellite, she became NASA property. But there's a lot of people out there that are doing some really, really crazy things. And there's super psychics out in China. There's some amazing stuff going on there. And I have actually got a very unusual sense There's no use for it, but I can smell things at a distance. I can smell things that are on telly. And say if someone's on TV and they're not very clean, I can smell that. I don't know why or how it happens, but also I can smell things by touching them. And I'll tell you, the first time it ever happened, I was just out of school and I got a job at McDonald's. I was 16 years old. And I was washing up at the end of the shift in a big sink of water. And someone walked around behind me and I could smell and taste hot chocolate really strong. And I thought they'd brought the hot chocolate machine around for me to clean. And I looked, expecting it to be there, and it wasn't. I thought, that's really strange. And then I noticed that when I touched something at the bottom of the bowl, I could taste and smell hot chocolate. But when I took my fingers off it, it was gone. And I picked the thing out of the bottom of the water, and it was a piece of the hot chocolate machine. And the taste was so, so strong. But I really like how it happened when it was underwater. So obviously I'm not just smelling it through the normal way. Mm. But, I mean, it's happened probably, maybe about 10 times since then, so in the past 25 years. And but yeah, really oddly, I can touch things, and every now and again I'll smell them and taste them. No okay. control, no use. But it's one of those things.
It's because it's not practiced, I guess. I mean, that's another thing that I feel, is that we've probably got a lot more senses than the five rely on.
Yeah. But I found no use for it. I love it when it happens. But there's just not much positive use of it, really. I'd prefer to be able to teleport. To be honest with you. I guess, an advert on TV for some food and I can taste it, aside of that.
How very strange. Sounds like a sort of kinesthesia, because I've met people who can taste colours and things like that.
Hmm. I actually perceive sounds in colour as well. Not to the extent that some people do, because I know that's a really big thing for some people, but... But yeah, I think I have got a little tiny bit of that. But I like it. I like anything that is outside of what we have been conditioned into believing that we are and what our senses can do. I mean, everybody has the experience of, you suddenly turn around, you can feel someone's looking at you. And when you turn around, obviously they look away because you've spotted them. We all get that. Everyone's had the experience of walking into a room and there's an uncomfortable atmosphere because someone's had an argument. I mean, these are senses that we experience, and we all know those senses. We don't learn about them at school, but we know them. I mean, that sense of knowing when a person's looking at you, this is something that that doesn't fall into any category of what we are told as humans we can do. Yet pretty much everybody has experienced it and knows what it feels like and knows that it's real.
I think Rupert Sheldrake's done quite a lot of experimentation on his website into the sense of being stared at. And it's been pretty successful. He also does experiments with people, getting people to phone other people at random times and finding out how many times the receiver actually knows who's on the end of the line.
Yeah.
We probably are the internet. I'm really hoping that we're going to be, version 3 of the internet's going to be, it'll be us.
Everything that's external is a manifestation of what we can create within ourselves. All of this stuff, so there's a lot of awesome things that are going on outside there, that we can do it without the external technology. I mean, the work that I adore is the work of Jungvalo Melchizedek. I mean, he is a conscious walking, and he's brought in the Flower of Life workshops and the Macabre meditation, and some of the stuff that he's talking about and he's teaching is just amazing. And he's kind of the spokesperson for a lot of the shamanic people of the world as well. But one of the things that he does say is everything that we see outside of ourselves, all the technology and all the really cool gadgetry and that kind of stuff, all this stuff can be done, and all these things, we can do them naturally as well. And when you look at the internet, really, that's a physical manifestation of a global communication of people being telepathic and what have you.
Which would be really great to imagine, that we might all learn to teleport and be telepathic. That would sort out all sorts of interesting challenges.
One of the a cool way to practice telepathy, I've got three cats, one dog. And one of the things that I do with the cats, if the cat is sitting across the side of the room paying no attention to me, I'll imagine that I'm creating like a ball of emotion in my hands. Like, and just put loads of love into it. And then I float the ball over to the cat. And when the ball goes into the cat starts purring. So I've kind of developed this a little bit. And the way that I use it now, if I'm out at a coffee shop or I'm at a supermarket or something and there's a baby crying somewhere, I can't stand the sound of a baby crying. I've got such sensitive hearing. So I just sit there. And I get this little ball of energy between my hands, the same way you would do if you was doing Tai Chi. And I just inject into it little giggles and smiles and happiness and tickly belly and all that kind of stuff. And then I float the ball over to the baby and just let it pass into the baby's belly. And it's amazing how quickly the crying turns into just a giggly laughter. It's just insane. I do it so often simply because I can't stand babies crying, really. It works so well.
No wonder you became interested in the kind of techniques, if you like, of manifestation, given that you seem to spend quite a lot of time doing it. I guess using your own techniques by keeping your eyes on your environment and looking for the synchronicities, you'll eventually find why it is that you can taste things that you can smell even if you can't see them.
Yeah, exactly. I like playing around with energy. The town where I live is a shopping centre. Everyone parks in the shopping centre and they all come down the same escalator. So I've put a massive ball of energy at the bottom of that escalator that everybody has to pass through when they go into town, and just filled it with loads of love and joy and peace and happiness. So quite often just the girlfriend will be in H&M. I'll get bored of being in HMV. So I'll go out and I'll sit on the sofas. I'll just keep putting some more energy into the ball of energy at the bottom of the escalator. I'll just watch people entering it and the change in their energy as they go into it. I just love doing stuff like that. But I think everyone's got that ability, that capacity. For a long time, you kind of do these things without being able to sense that anything's happening. I went and I did Tai Chi for a while. And now I do Tai Chi every morning, but I don't go to a Tai Chi class anymore. And also Qigong as well. I also do Qigong every day. And that gets you to a point where you can properly, really, really feel the energy. So now I know that when I'm doing these things, it is having an effect on what you might call the external world, because I can feel it. And, sometimes you can kind of see it a little bit as well. I haven't quite managed to develop that as much as I'd like to.
It's an interesting idea, that, isn't it? Because I would assume that if you got two or three of you sitting there doing it, you would get much more coherent effects, probably.
Yeah, definitely. Three people plus is the magic number. In fact, there's a story by an old lady called Helen Hadsall, and they called her the winning sage. She used to win all competitions. And she was doing a manifestation.
Great skill.
And she thought... that was her. Her skill was to win things. I mean, look her up, because she's just a phenomenal lady. But one of the things that she did... She manifested like a quarter, like a American, money. And she imagined it on the floor in a shopping center. And she just put all her energy into manifesting this thing to see whether anyone else would see it. And as she was doing it, a woman walked up with a pushchair, and the woman just happened to stop and start chatting to somebody just where she'd manifested this money on the floor. And the baby looked over the side of the pram, a baby with no conditioning, and put his hand out, well, toddler, and tried to pick it up. And the woman looked down at what the toddler was doing, and she was like, there's nothing there, what are you doing? And the toddler was trying to grab at this quarter that this Helen was sat on a bench manifesting. And then they went away, loads more people just walked over, and then an old man came over. He stopped dead in his tracks. He looked down on the floor where she'd been manifesting this quarter, and then he looked up at her and smiled. He walked over to her, sat on the bench, and he goes, I know what you're doing. And then he went off on his way. How cool is that?
Brilliant.
So when I found out that, when I read that, that's what started me doing the manifesting energy in the shopping centre. I just thought that was so cool. So it's such a lovely story. And I like how it was the little child without the conditioning, and also the really old guy who's gone beyond the conditioning, got to the point in his life where he's starting to thinking about what's really, really important. So that was such a lovely story.
Oh, and of course the old it's not there and you're seeing things or whatever and is kind of maintained. That's great though, that people, I think that's, what was that lady's name again?
Her name is Helen Hadsall, I think. Hadsell or something like that, but she's called the Winning Sage. So if anyone Googles the Winning Sage, they're going to come across her. She's such a fascinating lady. She's really nice, awesome lady as well. I've no idea if she's alive. I'm guessing that she's not, because she was very, very old when I first encountered her material. But she used to just find competitions and just win everything. So it's one of my inspirations, I think, which is why with my manifestations, the way that I normally attract something to me, I quite often do win things. I have won loads of things because it's an easy way of something coming into your life. So,
yeah. And I mean, this sort of manifestation technique we're talking about, I mean, we're not only talking about something that we're all doing every day unconsciously, because that's how the world comes.
Absolutely.
We're talking about an old, an old skill, aren't we? Because I came across it basically the same techniques recently in a book from the early 1900s, I think, by a guy called Napoleon Hill, called Think Yourself Rich.
Think and Grow Rich.
That Think and Grow Rich, that's the one. Yeah. And
all of those, the Master Key System by Charles Harnell, Think and Grow Rich, The Thoughts Are Things, all of those books are saying the same stuff.
Yeah, you know, and also the old Western occultists as well, because that was the one of the older references I came to, is that in order to cast their spells, they have to be able to physically manifest to their own senses things that are necessary to do that, a bit like your lady with the dime or the quarter on the bench.
Yeah, exactly.
And before that, I think the Christians, I've heard credited by several sources with being able to manifest what it was they required, which is why...
I don't know the actual quote. You might know it, I don't. But it's something along the lines of, whatsoever you think in the heart, you know, you can make real. There's a quote in the Bible. I'm not a very religious person, so I cannot quote scripture, but there's something in there that talks about if you can think it in your heart, then you can make it real. Now, there's a lot of people that think with the emotional part of their brain. That's not the same. It's like the HeartMath Institute in America have discovered that we do have thinking cells within our heart. We've got a secondary brain within the heart. If you can think with that, then you are going to manifest it. So this is all coming back to the idea of unconditional love. You are activating a part of you that is different. It's like when we went through a process called the fall, where we shifted down from fourth dimensional beings to third dimensional beings. That shift from a physical perspective was moving from the heart to the mind. That's what we did, and that's why we're in this duality existence that we are now. The ascension is the reversal of that shift. It's moving from the mind back to the heart and becoming fourth dimensional unity conscious beings. So we are starting to see from a scientific point of view, where we can measure it, that we do have this secondary thinking brain that is in our hearts that connects us to that reality that we used to be and we can be again.
And we could just hope that they don't. There's certainly too many of us now for them to burn us all at the stake.
Yeah. It wouldn't really matter, would it? I think we've got a few ways that we can ascend. We can consciously do it as living, breathing humans, where we transform our bodies. We can die and resurrect, or we can die and be reborn in the next dimension. It doesn't really make any difference either way. Our physical bodies, whether or not you want to get rid of this one and get a new one, or whether you want to take this one with you, it doesn't really matter. I think we're all heading in that direction, really.
I think so. I like to say, as a bit of a conversation stopper when necessary, I'm a hyperdimensional light entity. Why should I worry?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Also, why should I pay my tax bill?
Well, that's a very good question. We won't get into that one right now. So when you're working on your... On manifesting something physically, like your car or the home that you manage to manifest yourself, and like I say, I know several people who use these techniques. Do you have a kind of basic skeleton of an approach? Do you have a set of things that you always do?
Well, there's kind of the golden rule is being unconditional love, and to get yourself to experience the emotion of what you will feel once it's happened. So, in my Wishing Well book, something that I say all the way through is... I can't remember the case. I've said it so many times. The emotion of your desire is kind of what's going to get... I've said it much more succinctly than this. The emotion of whatever it is that you want is what is going to get you there. That's the fuel that makes it happen. But there's a little metaphor. I've embellished on this, but I didn't come up with this, and I don't know where it came from, so I can't credit the source. But I love it. So I want to share this with you, and it's the idea of shooting a bow and arrow. And... if you imagine shooting a bow and arrow into the target, there's a few stages of this process. The first thing you've got to do is you've got to aim at the target, okay? Now, when you think about manifesting something, aiming at the target is being specific about what you want. So in the case with a car, it was the make, the model, the color, the alloy wheels, everything. If it's a person, then it's the qualities of the person, how tall, what color hair, what music they're into, what their religious beliefs are, everything. Just get a notepad and pen and just write down as much stuff as you can. You need to think of this like you are an architect. And you are creating the blueprint for something so some builder can make it. But the builder is stupid. So if you don't tell them exactly precisely what to do, they're going to balls it up and get it wrong. So you have to be so specific about what you want. That's aiming at the target. Okay? Now, the next step of the process, if you want the arrow to reach the target, you have to pull back the bowstring with enough power to make it hit the target. That's emotion. if you pull back the bowstring just a little way and let it go, the arrow's going to land down at your feet. It doesn't matter where you aim, there's no power. So you could shoot a million arrows, they would all be on a pile at your feet in front of you, so you'd never hit the bullseye. So what the power is the emotion in the experience. So that is, you choose what it is that you want, you're extremely specific about it, and then you connect to the emotion of already having it, you saturate yourself in that, you make it big and bright and colourful and loud, and you really jump into it, and you properly feel the way you will feel when it's happened, so that it actually feels like it has happened, and the stronger that emotion is, and the better that feels, that's the power, that's the more you are pulling back the bowstring. But there's a third part. If you never let go, then you're just going to stand there forever, wasting energy with your bowstring pulled back, aiming at the bullseye but never hitting it. So you need to let go at some point. And the letting go is the point where you take this manifestation and you kind of give it to the awesome power of your subconscious that can manipulate your external world and set up situations for you that seem synchronistic in nature, so that you do end up getting what you want because you've enlisted this amazing power. There's no point trying to do all this stuff from just a conscious mind perspective. You need to let it go down into your heart. You need to let it go down into your subconscious, and then it goes out there. And I want to give you an example where people are doing this already. It's like in your house at home, have you got like a junk drawer, you know, where you kind of just stuff stuff and you think, I might need it one day?
That's what drawers are for.
Yeah, until you can't open them anymore, yeah?
Yeah, yeah, that's right.
There's stuff in my house that I have not needed since I moved into this house, yeah? We've been here for 7 or 8 years, and there are things that I have never needed. And every once in a while, I'll take one of the things out of that drawer and I'll be stood over the kitchen bin thinking, what possible use could this have? Why do I need this? And I can't think of anything, so I'll just throw it away.
And then tomorrow?
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly right. Well, not tomorrow. It normally takes 48 hours. Just enough time for
enough time for the man
to come and
that's
take
right.
it. That's
right.
Yeah. But what happens, and it's happened to all of us, is a situation happens in your life that seems totally out of your control, where that thing you threw away becomes so valuable to you and so important, and nothing else will do, just that thing you threw away. And this is because you have asked a question and then you have let go. Now, your subconscious mind that is connected to all that is answers that question by rearranging your reality, rearranging your universe, so that that thing does become useful. Now, if you just looked at something and says, I don't need this, and threw it away, that would be different. It wouldn't happen. But because you're asking what possible use could I have for this, you know, do I need this? Is there anything this is going to be good for? They're questions that get answered. So that is, that's where people let go of that bowstring. That's when you shoot the arrow. Now you need to imagine that the arrow is flying towards the bullseye. A couple of things can happen. You might think, this thing I wanted to manifest hasn't shown up in my life yet. This don't work. If you think that, it's like you've grabbed the arrow and put it back into the bow, and it never gets there, and you just keep on doing it. But if, while the arrow is flowing towards the bullseye, you think to yourself, that thing that I manifested, that's going to show up pretty soon, and I'm well excited about it. And every time you think about it, you get even more excited and feel better. That's making the arrow go even faster, so it hits the bullseye even sooner. When it hits the bullseye, that's when the thing manifests in your life. But when that happens, you need to see it. If you had your eyes closed, you'd never know that you've hit the bullseye. So you need to see it. You need to know that this thing's going on. So you keep your eyes and your ears open, and you look for things. You look for situations that might indicate that what it is that you desire is on its way. Now, what I've noticed, which I think is pretty awesome, if you want to manifest something, what normally happens after around about 48 hours, 72 hours, something like that, you get something that is kind of like saying to you, that thing you wanted is on its way. Now, when we manifested the car, we, first of all, had the similar car and that competition. So that was kind of like saying, you know that car you wanted? It's on its way, and we're going to tease you with this to let you know. Mm. Now, I've manifested sums of money before, and, you know, a couple of days after, I've had one of those checks from Tom Champagne from Reader's Digest come through the door saying, you won £100,000, specimen. But that's like an indicator to say that money that you asked for is on the way. So I like to visualize that like the end of the rope. And if I look at that thing and I'm saying, awesome, this is telling me my thing's on its way, I'm excited about it now, and I'm really excited to get whatever it is that I've chosen to manifest.
Can
it's
I just say,
pulling on the rope.
I think that's a pretty impressive response to the Reader's Digest specimen check, because a lot of people might hobble themselves at that point thinking, oh, look, sod it, missed.
I love it What's the Hugh Dennis program with the little kids?
I've no idea. No idea. I've been.
Oh God! Oh, the little tiny girl, they get one of those checks and she's convinced that they've won. She's saying, we've been told we've won this, and she tells everybody at school and it's so awesome. And she goes, we have won all this money. But yeah, it's really funny. But yeah, that happens. And it's kind of when you do manifest money, if you're specific about the amount, you might walk down the street and find just a little bit of money on the floor. Now, that's still money coming into your life. And to me, that's the beginnings of the journey towards what it is that you want. And I love to think about it like that bit of rope, and you just take that and you start pulling on it. And the way you pull on it is to acknowledge that sign is there for you to say you're on the right path, and you acknowledge it, and you have gratitude for it, and you give thanks for it, and you get excited about moving forwards
and encourage the cosmos to give you more of it.
Oh yes.
So John Jay's asked in the chat box, he's put, what about affirmations?
I think affirmations are extremely valuable when used correctly. I don't know whether I should say, I've got a friend who is in a bad place, and he constantly says positive affirmations, but you can see that underneath the surface it ain't good, you know? And it's kind of like trying to gloss over something without dealing with a real issue. Now, if you are saying, I'm really rich, I'm really rich, I'm really rich, in almost a panic, whilst you know you've got bills to pay and you're worried about bailiffs coming around your house, then you are not going to get wealthy from doing that. It's when you use an affirmation, get up and jump around, get your entire body into it, and get your emotions and feelings into it. It's like, I have said before that what you think about, you bring about, right? I think Bob Proctor says that as well. But what would be much more accurate is what you feel about, you bring about. So if we say the affirmation, I don't want to be poor anymore, okay? That sounds like we're saying we don't want poverty, so obviously we want wealth. But that affirmation, if you think about the way that makes you feel, the images that gives you, the image in your mind is poverty, because the focus is poverty. It's not so much your brain doesn't understand the idea of the word don't, which is what a lot of people say. It's just that statement makes you think of poverty. And because you are focused on that, probably feeling the emotion of worry at the same time, you will manifest more of that. If you say, I really don't want to be stinking rich, I don't want to have loads of money so that I could afford to buy a helicopter and my own desert island, what picture does that create in your mind?
Well, you start imagining, imagining exactly. Just that. You already have,
exactly.
Haven't you?
You imagine, even though you're saying you don't want it, you are imagining the positive stuff that, the wealth and abundance and all that kind of stuff. So what it is, whatever your affirmation is, if an affirmation makes you feel really, really good about what it is that you actually want in your life, and that's important. We're talking about what you want, facing towards the direction you want to go. Nobody wants to lose weight. Everybody wants to get thin and sexy and slim and healthy. People don't want to stop smoking. They want to become non-smokers. People don't want to stop being poor. They want to become wealthy. You've got to focus in the direction where you want to go. If you don't do that, it's like there's a Tony Robbins quote that says it's like driving forward looking in the rearview mirror. Pretty soon you're going to crash. Now, that is such a valuable lesson. The affirmation needs to be focused on what it is that you are trying to attract into your life, the direction you want to go, the final outcome, and it's got to make you feel really good. If the affirmation don't make you feel good, scrap it and get another one. But, I mean, if the affirmation doesn't make you feel anything, then that's like shooting the arrow with only pulling the bowstring back a little bit. There's no power there. There's no emotion. So it's just going to land on the floor and you won't get anything. You've got to get the emotion involved in it, and you need to feel good.
So, and is it helpful to write any of this stuff down so that it doesn't wander in your mind?
Oh, God, absolutely. Yeah, definitely. I mean, one of the things that I used to do, I had a little book. It was a lovely little book as well. It was kind of a leather-bound little thing, and it felt like parchment paper, so it felt a little bit more special. And I just used to write down in there the affirmations of things that I wanted to manifest as though I already had them. So I used to say, I really love my life now that I have manifested, and then say what it was as though it's already happened, as opposed to saying, I want more money. You know, that's not really going to get you anywhere. But I think if you think it, that's kind of one level. If you write it down, you have in essence already manifested it into the physical because you've written it down. So you've kind of moved up a level. If you've then connected your emotions to it, you've stepped it up a bit more. If you've shared it with other people, you're stepping it up again. If you can really make it feel so real that you can't even tell whether or not you've got it, then you've stepped it up again. One of the things I did today, I spoke to you a little bit about this when we was off air. I was over at the allotment today, sat in the greenhouse. And it was such a lovely, glorious, sunny day. So I decided to sit there in the greenhouse with my eyes closed, imagining that I was in some exotic location abroad with the sun beating down. It felt so awesome. And I got so into that meditation of feeling the sun on my face. And obviously it was hotter than it would have been outside of the greenhouse. that you get to the point where you think, am I in the greenhouse or am I on holiday? And you have to kind of open your eye and have a little bit of a peep. You go, oh, yeah, I'm still in the greenhouse. You know, if you can get your mind to the point where you've sort of got a check, then you know that you've hit the nail on the head. So pretty soon I'll be manifesting a holiday out of that, which I'm looking forward to.
Like I say, I'm definitely going to be taking some of these techniques on board.
Oh, yeah. And it's fun as well. The crazy thing, I mean, when I first started doing this, I really felt like it was work. It felt like I had to put effort into it and I had to find time to do it. And then I kind of got to the point where I realized if it feels like work, I ain't doing it right, you know? And it's do it, enjoy it, indulge in it. Be like a little kid playing make-believe and just really get yourself into the experience and have an awesome time doing it. There's an episode of SpongeBob SquarePants, right, where he has this box and he's saying it's your imagination and he's making all these things happen in the box. And there's the other character in the show, the Squidward, who's all pessimistic. And he's trying to say to Squidward that you can imagine anything in this box. And he finally gets him to do the thing. And that innocent childlike nature of being able to just shut yourself off from everything else for a while and just really indulge in the experience of your imagination, which is totally unlimited. I mean, I'm at home alone on my own. And, I mean, if there was a secret camera in my house I didn't know about, I would have been sectioned a long time ago. So I do such stupid stuff when I'm on my own because it puts me in a good state of mind. And I know when I'm in a positive state of mind, I can manifest. But everybody has got a little bit of me time, whether it's when you pop to the toilet or if you're in the shower or whatever. So use those times just to get a bit silly with yourself and just imagine that whatever it is that you want in your life, it is real. And indulge it in the same way that SpongeBob does, with that complete childlike innocence. It's just that is such an awesome quality to be able to do that, to be like a child. It really is.
I think also that, you know, we're told by the Indian mystics and stuff that when we're awake, we're in our least conscious state. And when we're in dream time sleep, that we're closer to consciousness. And when we're in dreamless sleep, but preferably still conscious, then we're the closest to pure consciousness, to the unity consciousness you're talking about. And I know people who practice manipulating their dreams and are realizing that it is giving them the ability to have the same effect on this kind of dreamlike reality that we live in. Do you find any of that going on?
Well, the idea of doing lucid dreaming and also astral projection as well, which is so closely related, that's something that completely fascinates me. It's an area that I've sort of like indulged in a little bit and then I kind of lose it and I get back. But I've always been a bit of an insomniac, so I don't really spend all that much time asleep. But I definitely think there's value in it. And I also think that when you do that, if you can get to the point where you are dictating what you dream and you're having lucid dreaming experiences and they do feel really, really real, but obviously you're aware that you're consciously creating those, then what you are in essence doing is the same process that I would talk a client through if they wanted to manifest something. You know, that's an amazing tool, totally removed from the normal waking consciousness and all the things that are going on in your life. And you know it's a dream as well, so that you know there are unlimited possibilities. It's like, you know when I mentioned earlier about throwing something away?
Yeah.
And then your world rearranges itself. If you'd challenged yourself to rearrange the world so that this item would become useful to you at a conscious level, you just wouldn't think that you'd got that kind of power to do it. But when you let go and you give over to the power of your subconscious and your connection to all that is, that doesn't have the blinkers on that we have at a conscious level. That doesn't have the limitations. So things can happen that seem so crazy to us when the thing actually turns up where the item is useful. And when you're in a lucid dream state as well, you kind of do allow yourself to think without limitations, because we do think it's a dream, I can do whatever I like, you know. So definitely that is such a valuable resource if someone's got the ability to use that.
I've had a mini version of that repeatedly, actually, especially over the last year or so, a sort of mini version of the throwing things away. And it's the moment when I'm trying it, because we have several different sets of stuff that we have to carry around in the van at different times, depending on whether we're crewing or gardening or any of the playing with geometry, a myriad things. And I find myself kind of looking at all the stuff, working out what it is that I need to put in the van, and my eyes rest on something and it's happened again and again. and it is in no way related to the thing that I'm actually loading the van for. And then just exactly as you described, 3-4 days later, the thing that my eyes rested on is exactly what I need, most unexpectedly. Have you got any tips for me actually noticing when that's happening instead of just leaving the sodding thing in the store?
Yeah, the only reason that's happening is because you are presenting your subconscious with a problem. You know, you've asked a question. And what you could do instead is ask better questions. So, I mean, what do you want in your life? Ask questions that might say that. So, I mean, if you got up in the morning and asked yourself some really empowering questions, how can I make my life happier today and enrich 10 other people's lives? How can I make 10 complete strangers happy and smile today and restore their belief in humanity?
Excellent.
Or how, between now and Christmas Day, can I manifest £100,000 in my life, have an awesome time doing it, and then do something truly incredible with that money that changes the world, that I am going to be proud of on my deathbed? If you ask questions like that every single day when you woke up, your subconscious mind is going to answer them, and there will be situations that are presented to you that if you take them, you know, you've got to take action, and you will be moving along a path that's going to make that your reality.
Yeah, well, that's very good, that. I like that. And by doing things that way, you'd be not just improving things for yourself, but you'd be doing something about the exponential chaos that actually surrounds you.
Ask any question you want. You know, it's like we have this amazing resource available to us. And I think when you look at all these different techniques that we've talked about, it doesn't matter what it is. They all have the same basis behind them. They all work for the same reason. We are passing something from our conscious desire to our subconscious mind. Now, you can think of that as an architect passing a blueprint to a builder. You can think about it as asking a question, then just letting it go, so your subconscious asks the question. And I do say subconscious, but what I'm talking about here is everything that isn't our conscious thought. So I'm talking about your heart, all that is, your connection to source, God, whatever you want to call it, just all the other stuff. But it's easy to say conscious and subconscious. You know, Carl Jung said conscious, subconscious, superconscious and all that. I'm not going to break it down into all that kind of stuff. It gets a little bit complicated. But to me, it's just a case of the stuff that you consciously think about and everything else. And it's the everything else that's got access to the awesome power that manipulates your reality so that whatever it is that you've managed to get into it becomes your experience.
So do you reckon it's worth me like really concentrating whilst I'm doing it and like really focusing my intent, but basically filling the van with a bunch of random stuff and see what happens?
Yeah, it could be a nice experiment. I tell you, I love doing random crazy experiments. And one of the experiments I did a while ago is I sat there and hypnotized my razor so that it'd stay sharp.
Did it work?
We're all made of the same stuff. Yeah. So I sat there. And I went for an entire progressive relaxation induction. And I asked all the molecules to line themselves up. And the razor, right, I did that. And then a few days later, I decided to connect to the consciousness of the energy in the razor. And I just became friends with it. And I kind of gave it gratitude. And I said, oh, thanks for, you know, being there for me and doing all this kind of stuff. And the reason that I'd done this is because my girlfriend had been using it on her armpits. And it was so blunt that it ripped my fingers to pieces. But I hadn't got any spare blades. So I kind of did this little meditation with it where I just made friends with my razor. And within a couple of days, it was like a new razor. It was insane. And I was shaving with it, and it felt like a friend. And every time I had a shave with it, I kind of said thanks. And I was like, there was this real loving relationship that I had with this razor. Even though, I mean, we think about things as being inanimate things, but when you really go down to the raw essence of anything, it's just energy. And when we use the term all that is to encapsulate what we might call God or our connection to source and those kind of things, we haven't got all that is and then razors sitting on the outskirts of that as something that isn't all that is. It's part of all that is. So in essence, it's a part of the same, you know, ultimate being that I'm a part of. So, I mean, I made friends with my razor. I had gratitude to it. It seemed to appreciate that I'd done that. And I carried on using that razor for probably about a year and a half. And it always worked like a new razor. Whereas now I've got a beard. So the friendship ended. We had to break up and it was a really, really sad time.
So it's little balls of loving, purring energy to the cat and loving energy to people on the bottom definitely. Of the escalators.
I mean,
and
it's
even
like that.
Even as far as your razor, I think now's probably the time to point out the unique Lee's put in the chat box. I keep getting a little voice quietly whispering, Lee, One man's spiritual quest is another man's witchcraft.
Yeah. Well, I've proper, I mean, there's so many little things that I've done like that. It's insane. But I hypnotized the remote control to think it got batteries in it and just to see whether or not it'd work without batteries. But it's stuff that, because my history is stage hypnosis and messing about with hypnosis with my friends after work and that kind of stuff, and generally doing things that you really shouldn't do, that enables me to kind of do stuff without worrying about it, without thinking about what people think about it. And every now and again, you stumble across something that probably most people wouldn't try, and you get a result from it. And the razor is a brilliant example of that. So are you going
to come up with a... perhaps you should write a short book of the most bizarre things you've done.
Yeah, and then get sectioned. There's been some really, really interesting little experiments. I mean, some of the stuff that I used to mess about with hypnosis was fun. The only reason that I could do it is because I got into hypnosis from stage, opposed to, you know, being a clinical hypnotherapist. That all came later. And some of it's really useful. I used to, one of the things I did that was really, really useful back in the day, 18, 19, 20 years old. We used to go out with a group of friends, and I used to hypnotize one of them so that tap water was like alcohol. So he'd get drunk on tap water. But when he touched his car door, he instantly sobers up. So he was the designated driver with no hangover the next day. So yeah, it was a really useful use of hypnosis, I think.
It sounds like, I mean, can you learn how to hypnotize yourself?
There is no other type of hypnosis, right? If I am going to hypnotize a person, think about it like I'm teaching you to drive a car. The driving instructor sits in the passenger seat and they tell you what to do. But you sit in the driver's seat, you press the pedals, you turn the steering wheel, you make the car do stuff. They just tell you. And it's exactly the same with hypnosis. I'll sit there and you'll be lying down on the couch and I'll tell you what to think. I'll tell you how to breathe. I'll tell you to count in your mind, think about your feet and all different sorts of things. I'll talk in a relaxing voice. But all that stuff I'm doing it because when I tell you those things, that set of instructions will enable you to hypnotize yourself. So, you're doing all the work, really. So if you don't go into trance, it's your fault. It's nothing to do with me being a rubbish hypnotist.
Your patients should be paying you. You should be paying your patients.
Equally as well, every time when you go to sleep at night, you actually go through the hypnagogic state, and that's when you kind of, you see images and you kick out a little bit, and you go through the hypnopompic state in the morning when you wake up. And it's just a different state of consciousness where your brainwave frequency is slowed down a little bit. You're not quite asleep yet. So when that happens, you know, you are going through hypnosis, but there's nobody there giving you suggestions. Now, the reason hypnosis works, there's a part of your brain called the critical factor. And if I give you a suggestion, the critical factor decides whether or not you should follow it. And it does that by looking at the suggestions that you are already following. So the stuff you've already accepted is true. And if it conflicts with that stuff, it says no, and the suggestion is kicked out. Now, during hypnosis, that part of your brain is kind of switched off. It either goes to sleep, or you trick a suggestion past it, or you just confuse it and you get an idea into there. And when that part of your brain isn't critiquing the suggestion gets into your subconscious and it is processed in exactly the same way that your computer is going to run a program. It doesn't know whether it's good for you or it's bad for you. It could be a bit of software, a game, it could be a virus. If it gets in, it's processed. And this is the reason why we have completely irrational phobias and fears. It's like we've accepted some programming because this critical factor wasn't really doing its job properly. We get a phobia, and then we keep on trying to say, spiders ain't scary, that's ridiculous. But the critical factor looks at the new suggestion, and it says, hang on a minute, they are scary, because it's already in here. So that suggestion, you know, sling your hook. But when you hypnotize a person, you switch that part off, you put in the suggestion that spiders are actually quite lovely little creatures, and then, you know, the fear and the phobia goes away.
Well, it sounds like you're kind of... releasing from captivity. It sounds like people have got themselves cornered and you're giving them access to ideas that they wouldn't otherwise have.
Well, it's like that part of your brain, that critical factor, all it's interested in doing is helping us and protecting us. And it kind of says, we believe all this stuff. We're here now, so obviously this is working for us. So if we carry on believing all this stuff, we'll be here tomorrow. So it's all about self-preservation, really. It doesn't really like it if you rock the boat. And if something's going to come in that really tries to challenge what we believe, will resist it because that part of your brain might think, hang on a minute, this is working for me. If I believe that new thing, maybe it won't work anymore. So that's a threat. So I need to stop that. I mean, if we can get good at ideas and good suggestions and good habits down in someone's subconscious mind, the critical factor protects those ones. So it's just doing its job. It's just protecting what's already in there. So if you're already, you know, if your source is already, it's keeping you like that. But if you've got a couple of problems in there, then it's keeping those as well. So, I mean, in that situation, you just need someone to give you a bit of a help. Weed out the garden of your mind. Plant some new seeds that are going to grow into nice, exotic, beautiful flowers. And then look forward to a new life.
So it's kind of like a mental detox, really. We build up a load. Yeah. And because we're always, by and large, all right, we don't have any way, therefore, of experiencing what was a real threat and what wasn't. And we build up a whole load of stuff that we could really do with releasing.
I mean, it's that the critical factor that I'm talking about, it doesn't really kick in until around the onset of puberty anyway. So, you know, for quite a bit of time in your childhood, you are just absorbing everything. So whatever, you know, if your parents are quite opinionated about something, you're going to absorb their opinions as well. And that's going to become you. So, you know, there's a lot of stuff that goes in at an early age. And also, you know, if we're confused or if we're shocked or if we're in a state of fear or something, things can slip in as well. And then obviously repetition, which is why we have catchy jingles on adverts and things like that. And also we mentioned the film Titanic earlier. A theme like that, which is very subtle, that's such a subtle thing that the poverty is the good thing and the wealth is the negative thing, that the critical factor doesn't notice it because it slips in there because it's a secondary message of the film and we're not paying attention to the secondary message. Oh, wow. So,
and that's the whole point, of course. Yeah. That's
I always think
point.
About, you know, if you're trying to get into a nightclub and you've got to sneak past a doorman, you get one of your mates to distract him. Yeah, I think about it like that. That is a hypnotic induction. You know, you distract him a bit and I'll go around the back. You know, trying to get into the cinema when you're a bit too young, when you're like 14, trying to get into a 15 film. I looked about 10 when I was 14. So I had no chance.
You only look about 20 now, mate.
Oh, well, thank you very much. Easy life. That's what it's all about.
So we're kind of in our last 25 minutes. So perhaps to have a sort of summary of the manifestation stuff, it's important, isn't it, when you're imagining what it is that you've received, when you're imagining what it is that you've already received, you have to be very specific, don't you?
Yeah, you've got to be specific. But also, I think that the trap that a lot of people fall into is they want something and they think about the thing that they want, but they don't fully associate themselves into that experience. So if you can see yourself in the image, then you're not fully associated into it and you need to step right into it. So, you know, you'd shut your eyes, you'd think about the thing that it is and imagine it all around you. So you imagine you are actually experiencing it. And one of the things that I think works really well, and particularly when we did the car, we used this a lot, was imagining doing things that will happen once you've got the thing. So rather than just focusing on getting the thing, there was a whole load of stuff that was going to happen. We imagined showing it to my parents. We also imagined getting that phone call. We imagined having the keys handed over. So these were things that were only going to happen once the actual manifestation of the car had appeared. So it was really good to do those. And I kind of took that a little bit from NLP as it goes. There's an NLP technique. One of the phobia cure techniques is where you project yourself to after the experience and then you pull that back to the beginning. So that's where I started using that, like to do with manifestation and the law of attraction.
That's brilliant. That's like pulling the future into the present.
Yeah, absolutely. Go to the future, borrow whatever you want, bring it back. There's another technique where you use timeline therapy, where you could go back to a childhood experience that was quite traumatic. You can drop down into that experience, give yourself a bit of a hug and say, it's all okay, this experience, you're going to learn something from it, everything's going to be fine. Come back to now and you'll notice that even though that experience was time ago, you have changed the way that experience affects you. Now, from a purely psychological point of view, what you've done is a little bit of a healing based on, you know, your emotional reaction to something that is at a time that you can no longer interact with because it's in the past. From a philosophical point of view or a more spiritual point of view, I believe that you are actually interacting with that experience. So you do change the experience. I don't believe in time as a linear concept. I just think that's the way that we perceive it in this dimensional reality so that we can handle it because our brains couldn't handle the way time really is.
You don't think you could do duality properly without time anyway?
course, no, definitely, of course you couldn't. But that's only this dimension. When we're manifesting things, we need to connect high dimensions anyway, and these are places where time don't exist. You know, there's emotion, but if you are going to manifest something, then you can have it in the now if you are ever going to have it. So you just need to connect to that place, which is all about unconditional love, and then you just tune into the emotions of it already being in your life, and then it's going to filter down into the physical dimension for you, you know, sooner or later. And there's a trick that I quite often use, and it's the idea of, you know, when you're a kid, and you get in your, you're going through the Cave catalogue or the Littlewoods catalogue, and you're circling all the things you want for Christmas. And there's something that you need to go with your parents to buy. Maybe it's something you've got to be sized up for. So you've gone, you know, it's a couple of weeks before Christmas. You've gone and they've bought this thing when you were there with them. So you know you're going to get it. And they bring it home and they wrap it up and it's under the Christmas tree. You need the kind of faith that you would have then in your manifestations. So you're thinking to yourself, I want this present for Christmas. I can see it. It's under the tree. I know I'm getting it. And every time you think about it, you get even more excited about it. And all you got to do is wait for Christmas Day. And then it can be yours. What a lot of people do in manifestation is they think, well, I can't see it in my life yet. Perhaps it didn't work. Don't think about it that way. Think, I've done the manifestation. I felt really good when I did it. So it is being delivered. This thing is already mine. I've just got to wait till Christmas Day. And then I can rip the wrapping paper off and I can enjoy it. When you think about it that way, every time you think about it, you get more excited. And if you feel good, then it's getting to you faster.
I like the other example you gave of that, which is when you order something in the real world and kind of, I don't know, press the return button or whatever, you know it's on its way. And really gave me a bit of a key as to how to play this particular game, because I know exactly how that feels. God knows I get to order things infrequently enough that when I do, I'm really excited about it arriving, and I know what that feels like. So I've now got, if you like, a bit of a template to try playing with the visualizations you're talking about.
You get little tingles because you know you're getting it.
So as well as being specific, once you've done that, once you've sorted out what it is that you really want and you've defined that for yourself and probably written it down in your little book, you then stay focused on it, don't you? You don't actually just forget about it and wait for it to happen. You can keep...
Well, there was a book out called, I think, The Cosmic Ordering Service or Cosmic Ordering Guide. It's by Barbara Moore. It's a blue book. And that talks about this idea of placing this cosmic order and then forgetting about it. And she says, if you start thinking about it, you're going to reset it. For me, it's like we are manifesting stuff in our life all the time. You cannot not do it, right? If you are manifesting poverty and debt in your life, then every time you think about poverty and debt, you don't stop manifesting it, do you? Don't suddenly get wealth. That's insane.
You can't stop thinking about it either. Exactly, it's all encompassing. Exactly.
Right? The trick is, if you think about something and you feel an emotion, you are manifesting it. Now, if you are thinking about something and feeling a good emotion and it's something that you really want, then you are manifesting what you desire. If you are thinking about something and it's a bad emotion, you're manifesting what you don't want. So if you've already decided to attract something, let's say it's a sum of money, and then during the process of it coming to you, you then think about it. You think, it's not here yet. I've got no bills to pay. This isn't very good. I'm a bit worried. Then you are no longer manifesting money. You are now manifesting debt. So you are attracting something different.
And operating from a position of fear basically has directly that effect on us.
So, you know, when we were shooting the arrows into the target, what we've done by changing our focus is we have deflected the arrow into a different target, which is a different manifestation. It's not like you are trying to manifest wealth and you either are manifesting it or you are not. You are always manifesting, but sometimes because your emotions change and your focus changes, you have shifted from manifesting wealth and now you are manifesting something else, like your boiler breaking down or your car breaking down or an unexpected bill. You know, if you can get back onto the idea of feeling really great and really positive and imagining money coming into your life and what you're going to do with it and how awesome it's going to be when it comes into your life, then you've gone back onto manifesting the thing that you want.
I think there you've hit on the absolutely core, crucial nature of this conversation, if you like, is that we are doing this anyway, and what we're doing as individuals is being reflected in the sea of humanity as a whole, and we are effectively many of us perhaps most of, well, perhaps most of us asleep at the wheel. And it's not a matter of manifesting good for yourself or being neutral. It's a matter of waking up and driving the sodding vehicle.
Yeah, exactly. But it's not easy. We manifest all the time anyway on autopilot, depending on how we've been conditioned. And what we are manifesting is what is in our lives. So if you're wondering what you believe subconsciously, just take a look around you. And it's kind of like, we are doing that, and you could fall into the trap of saying we're manifesting anyway, so if you take conscious control over it, it shouldn't be that much more difficult. But we're breathing all the time anyway. But if you try to focus on breathing and you physically breathe in and out consciously, you can't keep on doing that all the time. It becomes exhausting. You know, it is effort to do that. So when we're manifesting and we say we're doing it anyway, let's take conscious control of it, it still requires discipline. It still requires effort and commitment to do these things. But I think that when you start to do this and you condition yourself so that your automatic manifestations become things that you desire, and you put yourself in a positive place by conditioning your mind through repetition, you know, or whatever example that we've talked about this evening, then your natural manifestations just happen as and when they are needed. This is a prime example. I haven't been up on stage for a really long time. Perhaps the late 90s was the last time I was on stage. I decided quite recently that I didn't want to just write books. I didn't want to just bung stuff out on YouTube and stuff like that. I wanted to get back on stage, get back talking in front of people. And that's what I wanted. I didn't really focus on manifesting it, but I'd made the decision that that's what I wanted. And I get a call from Dij saying, do you want to do the conscious camp? Do you want to do the radio interview? And what we're experiencing right now is a part of that manifestation of moving in the direction I want to go, because I've conditioned myself, to automatically follow the stuff that comes up, as opposed to having to do it so consciously with so much effort.
And I think, yeah, I get that same experience, but that's because basically we've done everything we possibly can, at least for a while, to release ourselves from things like stone addresses and bank accounts and things like that. And it carries its own stresses as a lifestyle, but it does mean that every opportunity that comes up, I can look at it and I can go, hell yeah, there's a place to go for a couple of weeks. Yeah. And so I'm kind of living it in a different way. It'd be interesting to try and start actually steering the ship. And I do, you know, stuff does, as you're, despite the fact that I don't use necessarily any techniques or concentrate very hard on it at all, I do feel it's like there's this sort of small cluster of guides who know what's good for me, and they make sure that I kind of head in the direction that I need to be heading. It's tremendously exciting. Mahatma Coates asked, have you ever read the book The Secret?
Yes, I have. Yes. I actually almost wrote the book The Secret, as it goes. I mean, I got into manifestation before The Secret came out, before the Cosmic Ordering Service and all that kind of stuff. And I wanted to produce a movie that was very similar to what The Secret actually became when that came out. And when it did come out, I thought, that's good. I haven't got to bother now. So,
well done. Well manifested.
Much, much better job of it than I would have done. It was very professionally produced. And I think it's awesome. I think it doesn't quite go into as much detail as I would have liked.
I agree. I feel it's a bit like a Chinese meal. It kind of it sort of satisfies on the surface, but there seems to be something critical missing.
Yeah, but look what it's done. I mean, it was a bestseller, the book and the DVD, and it has introduced so many people to this subject. I mean, even if it's just put that idea into their consciousness that it is possible, maybe, that we are creating what's going on, even if they can't do it. I mean, even that seed in our consciousness is so important. I'm in awe of that movie. I just think it's phenomenal. I'm really, really pleased that it came out, because it made a lot more people buy my book. Yeah. And also, if you see my book on Amazon, loads of people say better than The Secret. So that's pretty awesome.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think what they've done is brilliant, because they've brought a subject that was very, very few people knew about it, and it was really, really behind closed doors, and they've made it public knowledge. But also, what they've done, there's a lot of incredibly wealthy people out there in the world that are using these techniques, but they never used to tell anybody they were using these techniques, because it was kind of frowned upon, and it's seen as something a little bit silly. Whereas after The Secret, we now get lots of incredibly wealthy entrepreneurs who openly say that that's what they do. That's the secret to their success. And I think that, above anything else, is really awesome, because we look at what they've achieved And then they're telling us, I achieved this by watching The Secret and by following these manifestation techniques. So we can now do this without feeling stupid about it, because if they're attracting, you know, billions and billions into their lives by doing it, surely it must be worthwhile taking a look at it. So yeah, I'm in awe of it. I think it is such an awesome a transformation in the consciousness of humanity when that movie became big. It really is. And I know it could, there could be a Secret too. I think there isn't. And The Power or something like that.
I think some of these things are kind of like, interesting gateway products. That's one of them, in that it brought
a load, nail on the head.
Brought a load of stuff to people's attention without necessarily giving them the tools to deal with it.
If it had been too complicated, it probably would have, you know, that probably wouldn't have been good. If it was a little bit more complicated, perhaps it would have been a bit intimidating. And I mean, there's a lot. I mean, my first exposure to this stuff was the Seth books from the 70s, Jane Roberts and Robert Butts. I found that book by chance. I'm stood in the library looking at the paranormal section. I've read almost everything on it. And then a book fell on the floor in front of me, a great big fat hardback book, made a huge bang, and everyone looks at me. I picked it up and I took the book out without even looking at it. And as I turned it over as I walked out the library, it was Seth Speaks, The Eternal Validity of the Soul. And that book was my first experience that we create our reality. That's what got me started on this path. So, yeah. I mean, it's heavy going stuff. And the thing is, made that accessible.
Yeah, yeah, I agree. I thought the same thing was true of, what the hell was it called? Dan Brown's Da Vinci Code.
I mean, exactly.
There's a whole load of stuff in there that needs attending to, and the whole thing might have been a bit of mind candy, but again, it put a whole load of people, a whole load of information into people's minds as seeds.
These things are so important for our shift. It really is. I mean, I think we are so close to ascension, and it's little pieces like that that are helping us along, because the humanity is not ready for the kind of knowledge that would set them free, because at the moment it's too complicated. But when it gets filtered out through movies and it just gets fed into people at that level, I mean, that's so awesome. It really is. And the people that are doing that stuff, I'm in awe of what they're doing, because they're making such a massive, massive difference to us. It is so cool.
Yeah, and like you say, encouraging us to look into things in slightly more detail. Unique Lee, there's another one in there, another question for you, saying, I guess you've read Eckhart Tolle too.
I'm reading it now, The Power of Now.
Yeah, I like The Power of Now. Yeah.
I've read The Power of Now ages ago. I can't remember any of it, but I come across the other day, you know, it's kind of like How to Use The Power of Now. It was in the works for about 50p.
Yeah.
So I'll have that. So, yeah, I'm reading it right now as it goes.
That was when I sort of got, when I kind of veered off the kind of the physical and material path. Gianvalo Melchizedek's Ancient Secret of the Flower of Life was one of
awesome,
the first things.
I
agree absolutely. And then Eckhart Tolle's Power of Now was another. And again, you don't necessarily take all of these things on board, but for me, there's generally, in the books that I regard as useful, there's generally half a dozen things in there that really change the way. And Eckhart Tolle, he's one of those guys that did it.
The James Redfield ones, all the Celestine Prophecy, I love those as well. Really, the control dramas, that really opened my eyes, because I was a poor me, and being a poor me is a real bad thing to be, because you moan about stuff to get energy off people, but you have to have bad stuff going on to moan about. So you manifest bad things in your life so you can moan about them so people give you energy. Such an awful place. And reading the Celestine Prophecy highlighted that to me, and I thought that was awesome. And
That book, I tell you what, I read that one, and I got right the way to the end before I realised it had been made up. I
travelled this far down this path. I wanted to retrace the steps through Peru.
When I read that, I was actually staying at Port Marion for a weekend where they filmed The Prisoner, which is an amazing place.
Yeah, I've been there.
Amazing place to read the Celestine Prophecies. It's always strange. Anyway, look, we're coming up to the witching hour, so we've kind of said that we need to be specific and that we need to stay focused in order for this to work. It's also really important that you believe you're going to get a result, isn't it? That's one of the critical factors.
Well, just having faith, I think, is the thing. You've done the work. I mean, sometimes when you're doing a manifestation meditation, you can kind of feel a little bit of a click that tells you that you've put enough energy out there. It's a really weird feeling, but it's like a click deep in your body, and you kind of feel like that's enough now, and you just let it go. And having faith, expecting it, And staying in that place of love as well. I mean, I've got to keep coming back to the importance of the unconditional love, because that is the most important part of the lot. If you think about all the processes of meditation, it's like the mechanics of a car, the engine, the gears and everything, and the ability to drive and all that stuff. Love is the petrol. You know, without that, you're going nowhere. I mean, you're going to manifest stuff, but you're going to get the opposite as well, so it cancels out and it's pointless. love is so valuable.
To a certain extent, visualising light from the heart and concentrating on the heart centre when you're doing this work is a good way of working towards that.
Because some
people might find it a bit difficult to imagine the unconditional love thing, but in a way you can use metaphors, can't you?
Yeah, I really, really struggled with it, to be honest. When I first started doing, the macabre meditation, you need to be experiencing love for it to work. So that was my first experience. And I am kind of a little bit devoid of emotion, to be honest. And that was a real challenge for me. And the lady, her name's Armana Sinclair, and she's such a wonderful, wonderful being. And she suggested the holding the baby kitten, and that's what worked for me. It's one of those things which the more you do it, the better you get at it. And I don't expect people who haven't done this before to be able to just jump right in there and be able to do that. But, I mean, just imagine what it would be like, whether you're a guy or a woman, it doesn't really matter, but just imagine what it'd be like to be a woman who has just given birth and just been handed her baby, and all you're doing is gazing into the eyes of that baby, and the baby is gazing back into your eyes, and everything else falls away. Just imagine what that'd feel like.
Utter terror, mate. Utter terror.
A life sentence now, that's it. But for some people, that would be joy.
So it
doesn't matter what technique you use, whatever makes you, if you feel good, you're doing something right. And it doesn't matter what makes you feel good. If you feel good, you're doing something right. Once you feel good, look for something that makes you feel a little bit better.
Absolutely brilliant. And if you can't get round to actually manifesting your Alfa Romeo or the complete home, the home that you manifested that we never actually got around to talking about, unfortunately, because that's another good one.
The house is actually in the book. So if people read the book, that's the first chapter.
And what's the book called?
It's called Wishing Well, A Guide to Creating Your Dreams Through Cosmic Ordering.
And I posted the links to that in the chat box. There's a bit more information on the site, which is called cosmicorderingsecrets.com, which I will just paste into the chat box here.
That's really just an advert for the book. There's a couple of stories in there. I think the car that we've talked about is in there, and also the holiday we didn't get to talk about, that's in there as well, with the Flower of Life, which I thought was pretty cool.
And you said you've got a new book kind of just coming out the coffee shop, like what's that one about?
The problem with Wishing Well is I didn't have enough focus on love. So I wrote what you might call Wishing Well 2. As yet, it's not really got a title, but I'm going to come up with a better one than that. And I think I'm in a different place now. I'm a much more spiritual person than when I wrote Wishing Well. Wishing Well, I come from like a psychological background, so there was a lot of NLP in there, a lot of hypnotic techniques in there. And the second book is much more from a spiritual place, and it's much more about just connecting to the idea of being connected to love. And it's easier. I think I've simplified it a little bit. So, I mean, if you don't really need the second one, if you read the first one and just make sure you stay in a place of love, you don't really need you just listen to this. So everything we've talked about is in there. Don't buy my books, just do what I've just said over the past couple of hours. I don't need you to buy my books, I can manifest money anyway.
And if nothing else, at least you've learned how to sharpen a razor.
Yeah, that was cool. I mean, if anybody wants the book and they genuinely can't afford to buy it, I do think when people buy stuff, it's an exchange of energy. I think that's good. When people give money and they get something back and they invest in it, I like that. That, to me, is a good thing. But if someone wants me to just send it to them as a PDF for free, then I am more than happy to do that. It's not like knowledge that I'm trying to hold on to and keep away from people. I want to spread this stuff, you know? And that was the reason for the book in the first place.
Yeah, and for those people with an extremely short attention span who can't read a book, I've just put Stephen Hall stephen@hall.info into the chat box, because if you want a real stripped down bare bones guide to how to try this manifestation technique for yourself, there's a load of little 2 or 3 minute videos there which do absolutely, you know, that's why I couldn't tell people about that before, because hey, I've just been talking to you for 2.5 hours and they could have done the whole thing in like 15 minutes.
It's kind of like a bit of an FAQ. Those videos came about from questions that people asked me, so I just made some little quick videos to answer the questions, really.
Well, I'd really like to recommend that you go and visit your own info site and just look at each of those in order and think, bloody hell, that's a really tidy summary in about 30 minutes or less.
I do tend to go on a bit, though, don't I?
Oh, no, it's...
They're going to have to drag me off stage at the conscious camp, because if I start getting into a bit of an anecdote, some of them are quite long.
I think that once you find yourself back on a stage addressing a live audience with this kind of stuff, I think you're just going to find that you absolutely love it. So that's really brilliant. Thank you very much for joining us, Steve. I enjoyed that. I know that it's given Lee a bit of an interesting time. Perhaps unsurprising.
I welcome questions that are a little bit negative, because that's where I learn stuff and things like that. I'm more than happy with that.
That's brilliant. Lee's typically try. He does this. He's really good at getting in the last word he's put. He says magic is dead, eh?
Sorry?
He says, Lee says, who says magic is dead, eh?
Yeah, no, not at all, is it?
No, well, like
Daniels
I said,
and everybody.
you're using, as far as I can tell, apart from the fact that it's a heart-based, which makes all the difference in the world, but apart from
absolutely.
That, the techniques are very much the techniques that have been used by occultists down through the ages.
Yeah. The thing for me, it works, it doesn't cost anything, and I'm happy to share this information. You can go and try it yourself. You know, it's not like I'm sitting here trying to sell something and I'm holding some secrets back. I want people to do this stuff and just experiment with it, do it in your own lives, and then see how it works, and then go and tell some other people about it. Kind of the beauty of the law of attraction is if I want to manifest things, I can manifest them. So it's not like I've got to, you know, some people get rich by selling people a book that says you can get rich by selling people a book that tells them how to get rich. You know, it's not like that. It's like, they really, really does work. And the more people that know this, the better. Because what generally happens is people will manifest gadgets and gizmos and cars and holidays first. Then they'll start thinking about what is really important to them. And this is when we're going to ascend as a race, because we'll start manifesting things that are just solely connected with bringing just utter joy into our hearts. And when we are all doing this, we talked about that blanket earlier on, there are going to be so many places on that blanket that are being lifted up. The entire thing is raised in consciousness. And it doesn't matter if we've got football hooligans that hate everybody, you know, because we're all going to be lifted together. And sometimes, you know, when we hit that point of critical mass, the human race will wake up one day and realize that we are all aspects of all that is. We are all light beings having a tremendous, you know, journey through this awesome reality and everything that it's got to offer.
And hey,
I look forward to that.
There's going to be a hell of a party when that happens.
Yeah, it'll be cool.
Brilliant. Well, I think that's a really great place to leave it, Steve. Thanks very much for that.
Thanks for the opportunity. It's been awesome. So,
not a problem. Really look forward to see you at the Conscious Tribal Gathering.
Yes. And, yeah, very much so.
And meeting face to face and maybe chatting some more.
Comparing
beards. Oh, yeah, definitely. All right. Yeah.
I'll go foraging with my beard.
I was thinking of trimming mine tomorrow. Perhaps I'll give it a miss now. I'll probably turn up looking like bloody Gandalf.
ZZ Top.
Yeah. Absolutely brilliant. Thanks a lot for that. Just hang on the line now. I'm going to put on Rob Heron and the Teapad Orchestra, Danse de la Lemonade, for the people. I'll be back with you shortly, folks. It's gone midnight, but hey, I know nobody's after the stream. So I'll play you some tunes so that I can go and have a drink with the kitchen posse. Thanks again to Steve Hall for joining us tonight. Really
Thank
appreciate
you.
Your time. And here's Rob Heron and the Teapad Orchestra.